Okay, g'day mate, Luke Ford here. I want to start with a bit from Tucker Carlson on a story that he's going to cover a lot more extensively tonight.
This is a screenshot of a man. At the beginning of the hour, you heard this sad story from Janice Dean about losing her in-laws. Both her husband's parents died in assisted living and nursing homes in New York after the governor forced them to take coronavirus-infected patients. The real tragedy in this pandemic is unfolding away from our view, inside nursing homes. People stuck there have no visitors. They are alone. What's happening to them while they're alone? This is a screenshot of a man recording himself beating a patient in a Michigan nursing home. It's horrifying. We're going to have a lot more on that story tomorrow and the tape.
Okay, so we'll be looking for Tucker Carlson's update on that horrifying story. I also want to cover the gang rape story at Big Dan's from 1984. It's part of the Netflix new documentary series Trial by Media.
Truck's rolling. I'm still slumped against the door. So I guess he's watching this girl come out of the bar and angle towards the street. So by the time we got right here. It was a, you know what? It seemed like it was more like a rock.
Yeah?
No, no.
No, I'd say
it was right here.
Yeah, right here.
This is where he's telling me, naked girl in the middle of the street. And when I finally stood upright, she was like in front of our truck, like this, like deer in the headlights, man. Like, you need to stop and help me. And I don't remember her walking around to the driver's side, but I'll let my brother testify to that one. So when I opened my door, she came running around the truck. It just literally leaped on me. She leaped on me, arms around my neck, legs around my waist, and she didn't let that position go until the police took her off. They physically had to take her off. And it got to the point where I'm trying to like get my arm up in here so I could get some air, because she was really putting a stranglehold on me. And that day, I was in the Marine Corps the whole bit. I never saw or felt fear like that in a person in my life. It was like total. It scared me how scared she was.
Okay, so this series is receiving a lot of attention right now because of the Netflix documentary Trial by Media. Big Dan's big story in early 1984.
On After 8 this morning, cameras in the courtroom. The question of whether justice is served by the televising of trials.
The issue of TV cameras in the courtroom is a hot one again. We have a debate over whether such coverage helps justice or harms it. Critics claim that such extensive coverage amounted to widespread voyeurism.
We will present what we think is an extraordinary look into the American criminal justice system.
Cable television is providing live courtroom coverage of a rape case.
There's been a very public rape trial going on in New Bedford, Massachusetts.
Shocking reports from New Bedford, Massachusetts of a young woman who was gang raped on a barroom pool table while patrons cheered. Six men were charged.
Gavel-to-gavel coverage of the trials went into the homes of cable subscribers. This was a first in television and courtroom history. From that moment on, viewers became armchair experts, privy to the same information jurors were.
Broadcast daily on cable television.
Daily broadcast of the testimony, both on radio and on television.
What is the news philosophy behind showing such trials at such length?
We have the technology. The question then is, why not?
So I was talking a few times over the past week about a chilling documentary on Netflix and on Amazon. It's available for $3, The Rise of the Warrior Apes. And apes don't ask for consent. before they have sex. Dogs don't ask for consent before they hump your legs. But humans have more developed mental faculties. They can live at a higher moral level. But we also are part animal. And this story seems to illustrate that. In 1984, apparently four men gang raped a 20-year-old woman at a New Bedford bar, Big Dance. And there are also two men who were charged for being witnesses and cheering on the gang rape. This later became the basis of the Jodie Foster 1988 movie, The Accused. So it happened in New Bedford, Massachusetts. It was entirely members of the Portuguese immigrant community. Most of the residents of New Bedford were Portuguese immigrants. The young woman, 21-year-old woman, March 1983, it occurred. The young woman was 20-year-old, single mother of two, so she obviously made a lot of bad decisions, did not seem overly intelligent. Neither did any of the men who were accused.
Big Dance Tavern, in a working-class Portuguese section of New Bedford. Police say there were 20 men in Big Dance Sunday night when the only woman left inside went to leave. One man locked the door. Another, according to police, threw the woman to the floor, tore off her pants, and raped her. As the men in the bar watched and some cheered, three other men joined the original attacker, carried the screaming woman to a pool table, and raped her over a period of 2 hours.
All right, absolutely horrifying story. But this type of behavior is much more common in the animal kingdom and among people with less intelligence. So intelligence is measured by IQ. Okay, that's a good proxy for intelligence. And so the ability to feel pain that you might inflict on other people, that depends on the ability for abstract thought. So empathy depends on the ability to have abstract thought. And IQ essentially is a good proxy for measuring your ability to have abstract thought. Part of the ability of abstract thought is that it enables you to put yourself in other people's shoes and to understand what's going on for them. So this kind of bestial animal-like behavior is much more common among low IQ people than high IQ people. And so all the people in this trial seem to have IQs under 100. And I don't think any of them went on to become rocket scientists.
No one helped her. No one called the police. No one left to get help.
I think we all like to think that...
So you need to know where you are, all right? If you're surrounded by low IQ people, life is a lot more dangerous because, among other things, low IQ people don't think as far in advance. They don't think as much about the consequence of their actions. When you're around higher IQ people, they are essentially living in the future because they see the future so much more clearly and so much more quickly than you that they're already essentially living in the future. And lower IQ people, they don't think as much about the future. They don't think as much about the consequences of their behavior. They are much more instinctual. They have less ability to empathize with others. And so from a higher IQ perspective, it's like they are animals.
Violent crimes don't happen in your hometown. Well, the fact is they do happen.
I hate this neighborhood, that's all. A lot of people are embarrassed by it. And I'll lose business like everybody else will lose business. They'll all be afraid to walk at night.
No matter what she did or said to those men had no right to do what they did to her.
Well, I think it's a crime. They should hang them.
So if you have an IQ of 120, the behavior of people with a 100 IQ is just unfathomable, right? You don't have any friends who are more than a standard deviation in IQ below you, right? We tend to have friends who are at about the same level of IQ as us. People who are, say, two standard deviations of IQ above us, they're not likely to want to spend much time with us because when they simply talk to us, they're going to feel like their brains are slowing down, right? Just like when you talk to someone who's two standard deviations of IQ below you, you're going to experience that as though your brain is slowing down.
The guys that did it.
There were so many questions swirling around the case, and people just wanted to know more.
According to witnesses, and according to what she told us, she cried for help.
This is the policeman.
She begged for help. Nobody helped her.
What was the matter with people? Why didn't they step in and stop it? When people heard about the cheering, it took on a life of its own. I mean, there's no other way to describe it. That made this a spectacle.
Local news radio director.
It is difficult to be shocked too much by a story from New Bedford, Massachusetts, which has been in the news since it happened on March the 6th. A woman was raped.
So much of the shocking factor here is the behavior of people with much lower IQs than our media elite. So, yeah, people with significantly lower IQs, their behavior will consistently shock you. Now, it usually doesn't hit the news because it's just too boring and too depressing. But the shock factor here is the reactions of higher IQ people to the brutal animal-like behavior by lower IQ people. That's the shock, right? Remember the shock that people felt when Trayvon's purported girlfriend was testifying at her trial and she just seemed so stupid that no one had ever met anyone like her? Well, she was quite representative of people with an 85 IQ. But people with a 120 IQ, they didn't know anyone with an 85 IQ, so therefore her behavior was shocking.
Raped in a bar. That she was raped is horrible enough. The circumstances and what that says about the people involved are worse.
The description of the crime was very difficult to listen to, and I'm sure it was difficult for people at home to even think about it.
The National News, three stories about crime and how it affects you. First, in New Bedford, Massachusetts,
a reported gang rape in New Bedford, Massachusetts shocked that community and the rest of the country.
I was competing with reporters covering the case from NBC, CBS, ABC, and CNN. We tried to cover the story as it was happening.
Authorities in Massachusetts today issued...
There's all sorts of behavior like this happening all across the world. It just doesn't usually attract media attention. It's not unknown in high school for a girl, or perhaps a cheerleader, to have sex with a string of football players. Willingly, unwillingly, this behavior goes on all the time, but it's usually conducted by people with IQs under 90, and it doesn't hit the headlines because girls who have a train run on them, they don't want to go public. They don't want to go through the grilling that this poor young lady did.
Warrants for four men.
Police arrested Joseph Vieira of Connecticut and Daniel Silvia of New Bedford. Two other men, Victor Raposo and John Cordiero, were arrested later.
So they're all Portuguese immigrants. They seem to all need an interpreter. None of them look very bright when you just look at them. And this woman's not very bright either. She's a single unmarried woman of 20, and she already has two kids. She goes into a bar to buy cigarettes, and then she stays to have a drink. And then she says when she tries to leave that the men wouldn't let her, and they gang-raped her on a pool table.
Indictments included charges against two men accused of being spectators to the March 6th raid.
At Our Lady of Mount Carmel Church, Monsignor Luis Mendoza said the men who watched the rape should be punished.
This was something really heinous, and no one did anything about it. So I think they are just as responsible.
With all six defendants arraigned on the indictments, the case was continued until March 31st.
Human nature is a lot darker than people want to realize. I've had girlfriends who had a fantasy of being gang raped. This is not unknown. Women often love fantasies where they're not responsible for their behavior, where they're the victim, where they're held down and forced to do things that they really want to do, but they can now credibly blame it on others who force them to conduct themselves such a way. Also, there's this nonsense. Yeah, talk about getting behind the eight ball. There's also this nonsense that rape is a crime of passion, or no, crime of violence, not sex. That's nonsense. If you just wanted to do violence, you'd do violence. But most rape cases don't engage any other violence beyond the violence of the act itself. Right? If rape is primarily a crime of violence and not of sex, then why is it that the only violence that usually occurs with a rape is the actual penetration and sexual assault? They don't generally beat the woman down. Also, all sex requires a little bit of violence. It takes a little bit of violence to conduct sexual intercourse. So I'm not taking one side or another on whether these men deserve to be convicted or not, whether the woman was 100% innocent, 50% innocent, but I'm just taking kind of the big picture view that the shock that is felt here is the shock by law-abiding citizens with IQs over 110 over behavior that is fairly common by people below 90 in IQ.
It could be the end of the year before it finally comes to trial.
This horrible local crime really did feel like a national story.
Nancy Fernandez, NBC News.
CBS News, ABC News in New Bedford, Massachusetts.
Yeah, headlines are like, bar patrons cheer while four rape woman 21 on pool table. And glib notes in the chat, the line that rape is about power, not sex, is feminist discourse and projection as women use sex to obtain power. The lift one imagines Luke stands in the corner, a single tear runs down his cheek. I'd been outraged. I would have just started live streaming condemning what was going on.
They kept
there.
Running
tavern rape shots,
stories
alleged
front page
gang
constantly.
Rape. The alleged gang rape shames New England whaling town. Yeah, what are some of the other headlines here? Bar patrons cheer while four rape woman 21 on pool table. Tavern rape shocks Eastern City. March 11, 1983.
The stories front page constantly.
Maybe our age of innocence
has
ended.
A lot of people kept saying, what's going on in New Bedford?
here's the headline.
The stories front page constantly.
Rape awakens quiet city to violence towards
women. A lot of people kept...
What about violence towards men or children? Why is this story primarily about violence towards women? She wasn't physically beaten. Four men had sexual intercourse with her. They didn't give her black eyes. They didn't break her bones. It's absurd to picture this as primarily a story of violence rather than a story of sex. I keep going back to the rise of the warrior apes. How did they conduct themselves? Right? Did they ask for permission before they had sex with each other? Of course not. I mean, if they took a woman, they took her. They didn't ask for permission.
We started to become aware that when we heard chimps farther than that, it almost certainly wasn't in go-go chimpanzees. Those are the others.
Who's out there? How many of them? I remember my first patrol out here to the north along Line Zero and trying to figure out what the hell's going on with these guys. It was Hare and Moya, Bartok, a few others. They're acting very strange.
So these researchers live among the chimpanzees in Uganda for about 20 years. And I was kind of stunned that none of the chimps attacked the human beings, but one alpha male ape forcing himself on a female ape, it's not regarded as a big deal because this is the way of the animal kingdom. Lower the IQ in people, the closer they are to the animal kingdom.
And they'd move off single file fashion into the forest. Where are they taking me? Why are they going this way?
Rise of the Warrior Apes. Okay, back to this Netflix documentary, Trial by Media, Big Dan.
Kept saying, what's going on in New Bedford?
It has been no less than international attention that's been riveted on New Bedford these last 3 weeks. More of it than has come this way since the great whaling ship sailed off into history more than a century ago.
New Bedford, while it's a city of 100,000, it's really a small town. It was dominated by fishing families.
Okay, not a lot of high IQ jobs in New Bedford. The economy is fairly flat. There aren't a plethora of jobs for people with IQs around 90.
Working people who cared for their homes, cared for their families. It was a great place to settle down.
Herman Melville once wrote that New Bedford, Massachusetts was the dearest place to live in all of New England.
New Bedford, once a major whaling city, is now the largest fishing port on the East Coast. Fishermen are almost all of Portuguese descent. Portuguese Americans make up 60% of New Bedford.
It was a melting pot, a lot of different folks there, a lot of different ethnic backgrounds, but certainly the Portuguese community, they've been coming here for a long time.
It's a beautiful city. It's a very proud community. The fact that we were getting so much media attention for...
So we can't expect immigrants to automatically have the same values, the same practices than we will. Obviously, if you have people of different genetic stock, different cultures, different ways of practicing their religion, you can't expect that they're just going to behave just like us, though obviously different groups assimilate and abide by the law at very different rates.
It's something that's so negative. It was a very sad time for not just the Portuguese community, but also for the city of New Bedford.
There was at the time a tremendous amount of conversation about the victim. Everyone wanted to know who she was. One day I got a call out of the blue from her Uncle John. I had represented him a few years earlier, and he said, well, that was my niece. She's very concerned about her safety. She didn't know what to expect. And he said, I just want you to talk with her. I remember driving down to New Bedford, going to the part of town where she lived, which was sort of a working class area. I remember walking up the stairs and meeting her for the first time. I didn't know what to expect. I could hear one of her children crying in a crib. She was just an ordinary 21-year-old woman.
Okay, an ordinary 21-year-old woman with two children and not married. So this is a woman who makes very bad decisions and has not been completely stingy with her favors.
She told me that it was in the evening.
So I just know from my experience when I was a player that I'd very quickly get a sense whether or not I had a chance to get a woman into bed and how much effort it would take. Overwhelmingly, in my life experience, virtuous women do not get sexually harassed. You meet a woman, you very quickly get a sense of how easy or how difficult she'll be, what kind of standard she has, and what it'll take to get her into bed. So tell me I'm wrong. Do virtuous women get sexually harassed as often as slutty women? That's not my experience. I could just immediately tell, usually, about a woman. Is she easy? Is she difficult? Does she have standards? Does she have no standards? Is she a slut, or is she a virtuous woman?
She had run out of cigarettes when she remembered that there was a bar on the way home that she could stop at the bar and perhaps get cigarettes. She saw a waitress there that she happened to know. The waitress sat down at a table with her. At some point, the waitress left the bar and she sat at the table to finish her drink. And when she got up to leave, somebody grabbed her from behind. That's when the event started.
At some point, she was able to free herself.
So I'm not suggesting that this is always conscious, all right? We're all unconsciously sending off signals. If you sell yourself short, there are no end of people who will take advantage of you. If you give off the vibe that you're vulnerable, there are no end of people who will take advantage of you. If you give off the vibe that you're helpless, there are no end of people who will try to take advantage of you. If you give off the vibe that you're a naif, that you're naive, that you won't be too much trouble, there's no end of people who will try to take advantage of you. So I'm not saying that people say consciously put themselves in a position to be mistreated. It's more like they have these unconscious habits, which then continually place themselves in position to be mistreated. Some people are constantly getting into trouble, right? Some people, trouble is their middle name. That's their substitute for accomplishment, that their accomplishment is constantly creating drama, constantly being in trouble, constantly seeking to be rescued. There are a lot of people who are just addicted to drama. They'd rather be addicted to drama than do the hard work of moving ahead in life.
She ran out of the bar. She was wearing, I believe, a pink sweater and nothing else. She flagged down a motorist. Three guys stopped and helped her. It was just appalling.
So in no way, shape, or form am I arguing that if a woman goes to a bar, she's asking to be raped. All right, that's absurd. But we do have an influence on how people treat us. We're not determinative. We don't determine how people treat us, but we have an influence. There are choices we make and all sorts of unconscious things that we do and just send off into the ether that have a profound effect on how people react to us. I mean, I know women who are just constant drama, just constantly seeking to be rescued, and who don't feel like a man loves them unless he knocks them around.
Obviously, she's been through a trauma that I can't even imagine. And I asked her, are you sure you want to do this, to see this through to the end? And she said, yes, I do. She wanted the world to be a better place for her daughters. And I thought, I'm probably not going to make any money from this.
This is her attorney.
But I want to do it for my daughter.
Right, so people get intoxicated by making a better world. And it doesn't mean that what you're doing actually will make a better world. So all sorts of intoxicating ideas that you have to make a better world, all sorts of intoxicating practices that you want to implement to make a better world won't necessarily make a better world, but often we use this, I want to make a better world, as an excuse to do things that we want to do. Right? It's an intoxicating brew to believe that by going ahead with something brave or unpopular that you're making a better world. But just because you are convinced that you're making a better world, it's not at all clear that you are much of the time. People, if they're disconnected from reality, they're quite unlikely to make a better world.
People ask for sex, but people do not ask to be raped. People don't understand what rape
is. Liz Bennett is the head of the Rape Crisis Center in New Bedford.
It's like saying that somebody asked to be robbed or mugged.
Yeah, sometimes that's absolutely true, but a lot of the time it's complicated. I remember a woman that I messed around with quite a few times, and then once when we're actually engaged in intercourse, she changed her mind. And so I stopped, but not many men would. Okay, not many men in the midst of intercourse are going to stop and change their minds. It's just that I am on such a high moral level that I have such self-discipline. Like my moral sensitivity is so finely tuned that when she asked me to stop, I stopped. But most people aren't on my moral level. Most guys are not going to be capable of stopping. But for most men, building up to a climax is like a runaway freight train.
Or murdered. You know, people don't ask to be defiled, degraded, humiliated.
A lot of people do ask to be defiled, degraded, and humiliated. That's an essential part of a lot of people's love maps, particularly a lot of women's love maps. So it seems that a lot more women are masochistic than sadistic, and a lot more men are sadistic rather than masochistic when it comes to the bedroom. So a lot of women do love the fantasy of having no power in the bedroom, of being degraded, humiliated, treated like trash. I had a girlfriend, I remember, she'd say, take out all your rage against women on me in the bedroom. Outside the bedroom, she wanted to be in charge. But in the bedroom, she wanted to be feel completely helpless, completely in the power of the guy. That's not unknown among women. So plenty of women want to feel degraded and defiled. Plenty of men want to feel degraded, defiled, and humiliated.
It was a huge step for someone who had experienced trauma and violence to come forward and to share their experience and their story.
You can never bring back that person who you were before you were raped. But there is a means through our court system to see some sort of justice. And you owe it to yourself to follow through on that.
We wanted to keep the focus on support for victims, but there was a lot of stigma about all violence against women.
Okay, so these are female rape survivors or who are banding together, and it's a complicated story. I'm sure, of course, there are many real rape survivors, and then there are more complicated situations. And then there are women who like to use the advantages that come with being a victim, and women and men who place themselves in positions where they can be victimized.
Some men still think of rape in terms of sex. It is, in fact, a crime of violence. And one of
that's absurd. This is Peter Jennings on ABC News proclaiming that some men think of rape in terms of sex. Well, guess what? A whole ton of men and women think primarily of rape in terms of sex. What were those best-selling novels about a millionaire who, or even a billionaire who has a sadomasochistic relationship with a woman? I mean, think about the movie Secretary. This is a prime fodder for romance novels. In romance novels, it's rarely women just signing on to give their consent. It's usually women feeling taken by a much more powerful man. 50 Shades of Grey. Yeah, so it's just absurd. It has no relationship with reality to say that rape has nothing to do with sex. It's a sexual act. If it was primarily about violence, then men would just punch someone in the face or knife someone or shoot someone. If, in most cases of rape, the only violence that has occurred is the sexual intercourse and no bones have been broken, then obviously it is primarily about sex. But our rating elites want to live in a world of delusion. They want to deny how intensely strong the male sex drive is compared to the female drive. Yeah, it's not rape if the man is Brad Pitt or George Clooney.
Of the worst.
What I thought was very important was actually that there was community conversation and dialogue. It was
what's very important is that it was community conversation and dialogue. I mean, that just doesn't make any sense to me. But what's the importance here of having community conversation and dialogue? Are we just going to, like, sit around and support each other? Excuse me, the creeps.
It's important to hear what people thought, even if it was painful, because we can't, you know, change opinions without knowing what people actually think.
A man only rapes a woman if she wants it. Now, if she goes to a bar and comes on to the guys, what do you expect?
Okay, so if you're a virtuous person, you're probably not spending a whole heck of a lot of time in bars, right? A lot of bad things happen in bars. You have drug deals, you have fighting, you have people taking advantage of each other, a lot of bad things go on in bars. Just like almost nothing good happens after midnight. Well, there are a whole heck of a lot of bad things that happen in bars.
I don't think they should have done what they did. But if she did ask for it, they should have just left her alone. There seems to be...
So all this talk about women who ask for it, it doesn't mean that they literally ask for it. You see it with men, too, who just continually place themselves in a position to be humiliated, degraded, and defiled. So it's not just women, but also men and women and children frequently place themselves in a position to be victimized. And if you do that, you're not consciously asking to be raped, but you're asking to be taken advantage of. And you may not even be conscious of that, but that's what you're doing, even if you don't know what you're doing.
A general feeling that if a woman is in a bar alone at night, that she's open game.
It depends on the bar. It depends on the neighborhood, all right? Obviously, this isn't applying to all bars in all neighborhoods, but if you're in a bar filled with low IQ people, in a neighborhood filled with low IQ people, if a bar attracts a bad element, obviously you're going to be at far greater risk than a bar in a better part of town filled with higher IQ people.
We realized how much misinformation there was about rape.
Rape is a crime which is frequently charged by people that have not indeed been raped, but have consented and then for one reason or another become vindictive later.
I knew that it could happen to anyone.
It's not like it could happen to anyone, all right? If you make smarter choices, the odds of being raped are considerably reduced. If you carry yourself a certain way, your odds of being raped are considerably reduced. Mr. Ford, do you think the grooming gang victims were asking for it in a non-literal sense? Yeah, I think that some of them were asking for it in a non-literal sense, not for the whole enchilada, but were looking for perhaps older men to enable them to experience certain things, not asking to be turned into like a train, to have all sorts of guys just run a train on. But it was overwhelmingly less intelligent working class girls who got taken advantage of, who didn't have many options in life, and so they would be intoxicated by attention, they'd be intoxicated by adventure, they'd be intoxicated by gifts, and so they made a lot of bad choices. And people with a lack of clarity, people with low IQs, people with fewer options in life, a lot more horrible things happen to them. A lot more horrible things happen to them. They were children. I didn't know. So is a 15-year-old a child? Not to me. A 15-year-old is not a child. So in Judaism, a 13-year-old is responsible for his or her actions. So, yeah, virtually none of the victims had fathers at home. So they were part of some sort of social and psychological dynamic that makes girls and women very vulnerable. If you don't have a father at home, if you don't have something good going on at home, you're going to be much more vulnerable to predators and to all sorts of bad directions. I didn't really have much of a relationship with my father. So I would seek to fill that hole by seeking out other older male mentors, people who'd play a father-like role in my life. Now, I was pretty good in judging who mentored me, and only one of them ever tried anything sexual. So I'm pretty sure that 98% of them were heterosexual, and even the one guy who was bi, when I said no, he cut it out. But when you have something missing in your life, like I didn't really have a relationship with my father, you have this huge need to try to fill that hole, and if you don't have good guidance, you will try to fill that hole in your soul through some bad ways. And this doesn't mean the other parties are off the hook, right? Just because you have a 15-year-old girl with no father, and she's seeking a father figure, and then she behaves in dangerous ways to try to fill that need, that doesn't mean the people who take advantage of her are off the hook. And Curious Gazelle says, Mr. Ford, many don't realize that this grooming gang story has been going on for more than 10 years in the UK. I had girls who went through this stuff, became professional storytellers for money at schools. No father, therefore, they were asking to be gang raped. That's trying to twist my words. No father, you will seek a substitute. And in all likelihood, you will seek a substitute that's not particularly good for you. The lower IQ you are, the less wise you are likely to be in your seeking a substitute. What do you think happens to people who don't have a good relationship with their father? You think, oh, they just go on as normal? You think that it doesn't change their psychology? If you talk to therapists, they'll often note that every single gay client they have has not had a good relationship with their father. Yeah, they were specifically asking for a substitute for their father figure. Doesn't mean they're asking to be gang raped. Right, there's a difference there. If you grow up without a mother, right, you're going to be looking for a substitute mother figure. If you grow up without friends, you're going to be looking for friends, right? Human being is wired to connect. If you do not grow up to connect in a healthy way, you are going to be driven to connect, even if it means unhealthy ways. Doesn't mean gangbang, but it means there are all sorts of destructive ways to connect. It could be alcoholism, it could be drug addiction, it could be porn addiction, it could be getting boy crazy, seeking feeling of excitement. Or I remember myself when I was in my teens, just being in love would make all my other problems go away. So I don't think I was the only teenager who experienced a release from their pain and suffering and feeling inadequate by getting high on love, of being in love, of excitement and drama around love and sex.
Didn't know who the victim was, but I knew it was a young woman who didn't intend to be assaulted. I said, we really need to do something. Let's show some support for that woman.
Okay, so people who work for $12 an hour, are they asking to work for $12 an hour? Right? People who stay in crappy jobs where they are abused, are they consciously asking for an abusive boss? No. But they consistently put themselves in a position where they are abused at work. It doesn't have to be a gang rape. Right? There are lots of forms of abuse aside from gang rape. So if you consistently have abusive bosses, that's because you're seeking that out. Because healthy people, one example of misbehavior by a boss, and they'd be out of there. They'd quit. They would do something else. People who stick with abusive bosses, people who stick in abusive relationships, it's not that they're consciously asking for it, but they have become wired in such a way that they're not seeing reality clearly and they're not making good decisions. So do people ask to be treated badly at work? Do people ask to be treated badly in their relationships? Do people ask that other people regard them with contempt? No, nobody consciously seeks that, but people put out signals that make that happen again and again and again. And if you were to rescue them and to treat them well and get them a good job, they would find a way to return to a state that is normal and comfortable to them, such as being abused.
We organized a rally, a candlelight vigil, literally within a couple days.
It's not often that an individual rape case evokes widespread demonstrations of outrage, but one case in Massachusetts has unleashed a storm of protest.
And Curious Gazelle says, with gays, I feel it's not just the lack of a male role model. I find many women in the Anglosphere turn their sons into gays just because they want a friend to gossip with. So I remember therapist Mark Smith said that all of his homosexual clients all of his gay male clients. None of them had good relationships with their fathers, so they grew up over-identifying with their mothers, and then, as a result of that, they came to eroticize male attention. So if you're a boy and you grow up and you overly identify with your mother, it's going to cause you some trouble. So a normal boy, about age 13, 14, 15, he will distance himself from his mother. So I essentially stopped talking to my stepmother during my teenage years. Not 100%, but definitely distance myself. And from what I've seen, that's pretty normal.
Steve Young tells us why.
2,500 people turned out to protest the gang rape of a 21-year-old woman in a bar in the fishing town of New Bedford. Organized as a silent vigil, feelings of fury could not be contained.
And Franz asked, did they ask to get chopped up and put into kebab meat? Well, some people don't have a particularly strong hold on life. Some people don't have a strong desire to go on living. Some people, yeah, they do want to be obliterated, whether it's by alcohol, whether it's by drugs, whether it's just by TV or porn. A lot of people seek obliteration. And in their quest for obliteration, they will put themselves in circumstances where their lives are in danger. Now, usually they're not deliberately asking to be chopped up, but do a lot of people seek obliteration? Do a lot of people keep putting themselves in dangerous situations where their life is at risk? Yes.
I think that this demonstration is beautiful. It shows that people really care.
Cases have gone unsolved. Women are afraid to fight for their rights because of the fear of what people will say.
We may speak different languages. We are different colors. And yet we are standing together.
So it's another case of everyone wants to blame the problems out there. The problem is lack of law enforcement. The problem is lack of kindliness among attorneys. The problem is the brutality of men. All these big rallies against rape, they don't want to talk about the choices that women make, consciously or unconsciously, that put themselves in more or less danger. That's not as exciting as saying, oh, the problem's out there. Saying the problem is to do with you and the choices you make, nobody wants to say that. That's way too confrontational. It's just not very popular. Tell a group that its problems belong outside the group. That's a very popular message. Curious Gazelle says, the notion of gang rape is highly feudal. Don't think it's been a common sexual behavior among Western whites for centuries. It's normal in feudal cultures such as India, Pakistan, and Nigeria. Among Africans, Muslims, and Eastern Europeans. Lib says, I know a woman who gave her son Barbie dolls for Christmas. Though he showed no interest, he grew up to be non-binary. The Eastern Europeans is primarily limited to certain ethnic groups. They didn't put themselves in those circumstances. How do you know? You're not aware, Franz, of people putting themselves deliberately in dangerous circumstances. That just happens to them. They're just completely out of luck, and that's all it is. That's nonsense. A lot of people deliberately put themselves in dangerous circumstances. Did Trapelli, the ape, ask to be beaten to a bloody pulp? He engaged in behavior that made that more likely to come around. 14 years old and younger don't seek obliteration. Then you don't know kids. A whole bunch of kids do seek obliteration. It's not even necessarily their fault, but by life circumstance, they hate the world that they have. They hate their parents, they hate their home, they hate their community, they hate how unpopular they are, and they just want to hide. People always want to make these external changes, but these issues are primarily internal issues. These issues are not primarily about, you know, law enforcement and institutions and people out there. These issues are primarily about us. And if we have wiring that consistently leads us into humiliating circumstances, if we have ways of thinking and speaking and behaving that consistently lead us into debting or under-earning or into toxic use of porn or associating with dangerous people or just frequently needing to feel obliterated, then we need a fundamental rewiring of our neural circuits. That's hard. That takes a lot of work. So much easier to say the problem's out there.
Because we believe that rape shouldn't happen.
Yeah, we believe that rape shouldn't happen. Well, how about we believe that women should not lie to men? How about we believe that women should not deceive men? How about we believe that women should not manipulate men? How about a rally for that? Can you imagine women's groups organizing a rally where the whole point is to say, women, we should stop manipulating men. We should stop using sexuality to manipulate men. We should stop lying to men. We should stop deceiving men. We should stop doing the dirty to men. And if we behave better to men, then surely they will be influenced and affected by that to behave better towards us. No women's group would ever say that, but it's the hard truth. When men behave better to women, women behave better to men. When women behave better to men behave better to women. But no one's going to stage a powerful, successful rally with tens of thousands of people where the whole theme is personal responsibility.
Our diversity is our strength. Our
really?
Unity is...
Our diversity is our strength. This is an anti-rape rally. So are rape rates identical? The perpetrators of rape just identically constituted from all groups equally? Or are some groups more likely to commit rape than other groups? If it's true that some groups are more likely to commit rape than other groups, how exactly is diversity our strength? Yeah, the behavior of both sexes is frequently out of order. But men would rather believe frequently that all their problems are the fault of women, and women would frequently rather believe that all their problems are the fault of men. And people with this attitude do not succeed in life. It's a loser's attitude.
It's our power.
When I stood up to speak, I looked out at the sea of faces, and there were people as far as I could see. I realized we had done something big.
Right. Imagine if she had stood up and said, we need to take personal responsibility. We are making choices that put us in danger. We are making choices that cause men to hate women. So in the workplace, a woman wearing a low-cut top, right? If you, the man, remark on it, you're accused of sexual harassment. But she's sexually harassing the men in the workplace. Women who dress in a slutty, suggestive way in public, they are sexually harassing men. If you simply point out what they're doing in the workplace, you will get in trouble. So how about... Could you imagine one of these speakers at one of these Take Back the Night rallies saying, hey, we women need to behave better. We need to stop lying, deceiving, cheating, manipulating. We need to stop trying to turn up the thermostat for men when we want something and when we want to take advantage of their weakness.
This is a lot bigger than the city of New Bedford. It was overwhelming.
The marchers say until the rapists and those who watched are prosecuted, they will not be satisfied that justice has been done. Steve Young, CBS News, New Bedford.
Not going to get a lot of satisfying justice for low IQ people because they consistently fail to see reality very clearly and they consistently behave in ways that put themselves in danger. They don't make good choices. And it's so intoxicating to believe that the problems confronting low IQ people are outside of them, that if we just change society, change the laws, if we just prosecute rapists, then things are going to get a lot better. Happen, not going to work.
Four men, all Portuguese nationals, were in court this week charged with a rape.
Also in court today were two men who saw the alleged rape. They too were being charged as accessories.
The six defendants, Portuguese immigrants, plead innocent.
the media kept talking about the fact that these were Portuguese immigrants. Why keep mentioning the fact that they're Portuguese?
Because that's what we do. We notice things. That is human nature. If they'd all been Orthodox Jews, the media would have talked about they were all Orthodox Jews. If they were all Roma, the media would have talked about they were all Roma. Obviously, people who are nationals from another country, who are immigrants to America, aren't necessarily going to feel the same loyalty to fellow Americans that someone who grew up here might. Obviously, a Portuguese community. There aren't that many Portuguese in America. If all four people accused of rape and both people who are accused of cheering on the rape, if they're all Portuguese nationals, of course, that's just human nature. You're going to notice these things. That's why our behavior has an effect on how groups that we're a part of are then perceived. But angry people in this documentary are so upset that being pointed out that Portuguese nationals are accused of these crimes, what they're angry with is reality. And getting angry with reality is not a recipe for success in life, not a recipe for getting along with other people, not a recipe for moving ahead, for achieving things, not a recipe for tranquility, but they get media attention when they persist in their delusion.
Because it had nothing to do with us.
What do you mean it had nothing to do with you? There were six, apparently, Portuguese nationals who committed a crime that most Americans found horrifying.
Since the rape, more than the city's image has been tarnished. Half of the population is of Portuguese descent. And increasing ethnic tension has embittered many residents.
The incident has unleashed a tidal wave of prejudice against the Portuguese people here.
When it came out that there were people cheering during the rape, it really got us upset.
Of course. When there are news stories about Jews cheating on Wall Street, you think this has an effect on how non-Jews regard Jews? Yeah, it does have some effect. If you have news stories about astronomical rates of black crime, it has an effect on how blacks are regarded. If you have stories on Mexican immigrants committing rape, that's going to affect how Mexicans are regarded. We're not just individuals, we're also members of groups.
That is absolutely horrible. That is not who our Portuguese community is. And so that just basically puts salt in the wound that was already pretty bad.
This is WBSM New Bedford at 1420 on your radio dial, the voice of the people. I'm Rob Michaels.
People started to call the rape.
So the average IQ in Portugal is 95. So England is about 99. For Italy and Germany, it's about 102. China, Korea, Japan, it's about 105. And get corresponding crime rates that much begin to match up with these average IQ levels.
Radio station almost immediately to air their opinions. It got to be pretty angry for a while.
It's the open line talk show. Let's take some more phone calls.
They contribute nothing to this country. They don't understand our ways, nor do they want to understand. But this country is not like Portugal.
They buy a broken down house, they fix it up beautifully, they do all these nice things, but they don't try to learn the law of the land. They don't try to become involved in the community.
We were looked at as not being civilized. Our morals were being attacked, the whole community.
Right. If you have six members of your community charged with gang rape, yeah, you're not going to be look very civilized. So this woman is angry at these perceptions, but these perceptions are based on the real behavior of some members of the community. So it's a lot easier to say, oh, the problem is these outside perceptions. Right? That's so easy to do. What's really hard to do, say, hey, our community needs to behave better. Right? If people, when they interact with the Portuguese, generally have neutral or positive experiences, then people will develop neutral or positive views of Portuguese. If when people interact with Jews, they either have neutral or positive experiences, then that will affect the way they view Jews and Asians and Mexicans.
He's being dragged to the mud.
all of a sudden they see the Portuguese name on Time magazine, on all the networks. Why the ethnic aspects of the crime? Why say we're for Portuguese?
These are not Portuguese blacks, it's white.
It's immigrants. Why don't they just four men?
So are the people...
Because we don't just see people as men and women. We belong to groups. That's the natural human inclination. We want to know what tribe someone belongs to. Know what group they belong to. We notice things. Evolutionary adapted over millennia of natural selection to notice things, because when you notice things, you navigate the real world much more effectively.
Turning out like animals out there, and we're going to end up with the same racial problem like we had with the blacks back in the 60s.
There were people on radio talk shows and in letters to the editor of the local newspaper calling for all of us to be put on a boat and shipped out of here.
Yeah, and it'd be the same if these were six Orthodox Jews who were charged with this heinous crime, or if it was six Mexican immigrants. All right, you have a Portuguese community, and everyone here in this case who's accused of a crime is a Portuguese national. That's going to affect how your group is viewed.
As more and more information came out, it became larger and larger.
This is leaving a bad taste in my mouth, and I'll never forget it. As long as I live, what they did to the Portuguese people, they ought to be ashamed of themselves.
Yeah. Such classic human nature. They're blaming outsiders for noticing that everyone in this heinous case who's accused of a crime is a Portuguese national. And they're on a jihad. They feel all self-righteous, that it's outrageous that the Portuguese community is stigmatized. But it would be weird and unhealthy if people didn't notice this kind of behavior and then think a second time about the Portuguese community.
Who's they?
Oh, the people who called your program. Don't deny it. Remember, the Portuguese people's never going to forget this. As long as we live.
Could you imagine leaders of this Portuguese community say, we're not going to forget this as long as we live, and we're going to use it as a spur to behave better, to teach our young men not to rape, to teach members of our community not to commit crimes, to teach members of our community that it's much more honorable to work than to take welfare. Right? How do you think that kind of message would go over? Wouldn't be very popular, the message blaming all your problems on outgroups.
On March 6th of 1983, a woman walked into Big Dan's Tavern, and what happened after that is, as in all these cases, in some dispute right now.
At first, we had great sympathy for the victim in this case.
She was violated. If she could be standing there asking for it, unless they left the public bar that they were in, she was violated. She was violated not only by one man, but she was violated by six men.
And then there developed a public backlash. And you saw this particular swing of the pendulum.
Some people have asked, did she ask for it? What was she wearing? Why was she alone? Did she know anybody in the bar? Does that matter?
You started to hear things about the poor victim in this case. Public questions about her history, her reasons for being in that bar. What seemed to me to be totally baseless accusations about her.
When's rape? You know, you got to, maybe she went in and wanted to lay a couple of guys and it got out of hand. But I don't know, you know, it happened.
That became the public.
You don't want to be around people doing bad things. You don't want to place yourself in a position where you're going to run into a lot of people who do bad things. You don't even want to be a victim of people doing bad things, because the way life works is that it's going to affect your own standing, your own status, your own prestige, the way other people view you. So therefore, you need to make very careful decisions about where you go and how you act and who you hang out with.
Conversation and controversy, of course, breeds controversy.
This is the sort of thing that causes rape. When people like you can stand up...
You know the story. I don't know the story.
I know the story.
That doesn't cause rape. What causes rape is that men have huge levels of testosterone compared to women, about 20 times the testosterone rates that women have. So men, generally speaking, have about 20 times the sex drive as women.
Well, then you should read the paper.
Yes, I've seen girls do this.
Yeah, but don't get crazy now. We're here to learn.
That's where we stood when I first entered this case.
The defense attorney. So each of the defendants had a separate defense attorney. So six separate defense attorneys who all got to have a go, essentially, at this woman bringing the accusation of rape.
The idea of coming forward in any criminal case as a witness or a victim is a very difficult task. And that was not lost upon me.
She does not have to come forward. There's no law that she has to come forward, that she has to testify. So if you don't want to come forward, then you could just learn something from the situation, not place yourself in those situations again. Try to teach people and educate people and influence people to avoid bad situations, but that's not nearly as dramatic and as easily emotionally satisfying as I'm going to make a better world by making this a court case, a criminal case. Could you imagine someone who's the victim of a crime instead deciding, okay, I'm going to make better decisions in the future, and to the extent that I can influence other people, I'm going to try to influence them to make better decisions as well.
I first met the victim in her living room. I remember that house. I remember it being so very close to Big Dan's Tavern.
And this is the district assistant.
We sat down in the living room and talked. Bob Kane, another prosecutor, was there at the time.
She felt, like anyone in New Bedford felt, the extreme intensity of the emotions surrounding this case. She was living in the community, and she was living there with her family. She had to be fearful.
So you can learn a great deal about the trajectory that this woman is on by how she ended. So she ended up dying about 2 years after the case in a drunk driving accident. So she had a blood alcohol level about three times level. So she had a drinking problem. She had a lifetime of making terrible decisions. So upthrust of this documentary is that it's the fault of this cruel, callous system that she ends up drinking herself to death. But no, it wasn't the system that forced her to imbibe huge amounts of alcohol and then go driving. This is a heavily self-destructive woman. It wasn't the rape and it wasn't the trial that destroyed her. It was a woman who'd made a whole lot of bad decisions prior to this. Unmarried mother of two. Not very smart. She was going to secretarial school, trying to do the best she could with having a 90-95 IQ.
We talked about the need for her to testify for this case, to successfully prosecute the men who had committed these outrageous acts upon.
So she could have walked away. And sometimes you got to know when to walk away. You got to know when to hold them, when to fold them, when to walk away, and when to run. So if this case had a hugely negative impact on her, she chose to go forward with testifying. She could have walked away. Could have just learned some lessons from this horrific event. I'm not suggesting that she, what course she should take, but whatever course you take in life, you then have to pay a price. So she paid a price for testifying. He would have paid a price by not testifying. There's no free lunch.
Honor, and over time, she came to see the wisdom of that point of view.
Along with District Attorney Ronald Pina, we tried to prepare her the best we could. That's the real work of a prosecutor. My goal was get her to be able to tell her story. And if we do that, we can get through this.
There's only so much preparation you can do for people with a below average IQ.
I
I had never before been exposed as a judge to any case that had such media interest.
It is in this late 1800s second-floor courtroom that the drama will unfold. There is not much room for spectators here. Most people will learn the details of the highly emotional case from the throng of media expected to descend on the courthouse.
Yeah, there was a symposium last few years about the case, and the judge testified, so let me play a little bit of this video.
Stand for! And I said, you're not asking the right person, I don't know. I'm a cabinet maker. Cabinet makers make cabinets. I do trials. And it is entirely for other people to judge both process and what it stands for. On the technical, legal side, the decision was affirmed, and like any superior court justice, I got on to other cases. Trials are as much the lawyers as the judge, and as much the court support as the judge. And a very wise attorney once said to me, we are all on the same team, the justice team. We just play different positions. And there's so much truth to that. But you know, the most important people are here. Juror. None of the jurors are here. They're anonymous. They came from anonymity to perform this extraordinary public function in the midst of searching scrutiny and having done the task which under our system only jurors can do. Only the people. It's guaranteed by the Declaration of Rights. It's also in the Constitution of the United States, but we don't need that. It's guaranteed by the Declaration of Rights to the Constitution of Massachusetts that...
Okay, this guy's really boring. But play him at 1.75.
People shall decide in a criminal case. And they're not here. They're going back in 10 minutes. Think about that. They disperse. They don't write books. They're not invited back to give their critique of the trial. We only ask of them a fair and an impartial And I thought that rather than do one trial, and however it resulted, it would be more of a publicity in the community and the like, it would be harder to get an impartial jury, and I also thought that the victim would have to go through it twice. So I thought, well, we could do it, we'll just do long days, we'll do one in the morning and one in the afternoon, and we'll let other people judge how that worked. But we weren't into the case more than, say, 2 days before I realized that in one respect, I had made an enormous mistake. And that is, and every judge here will understand, is trials are linear, and you quickly develop an ear for the essential elements of proof. Because if the essential elements of proof are missing, it'll never get to the jury. So every judge is sitting there. The judge, in a jury case, is not deciding. The judge is only teaching the jury. But the judge is listening to see whether a witness testifies to certain absolutely essential things. Well, you can't run the trial at the same time. Because I hear something in the morning, and I couldn't put it out of my mind. Then I got to the afternoon, I didn't know whether I heard it. I regret to this day, I'm here to acknowledge it before all of you, that I allowed the victim's name to be published. I could have prevented that. There was a delay in the television. I could have put in my order, and I handed me it. It never occurred. And her name, of course, because it's all real time, the name, we don't talk about Jane Doe, we talk about real people. Real people are embodied. This woman was horribly brutalized by the fact of rape, and in the very first day of the trial, her name was out. And the press picked it up, and the press had some denied code, and I remember the press members. They said, well, it's on TV, we can mention it, this must be the new thing. That's a terrible mistake. I regret it, that's all I can say. I regret it to this day. She moved away from the community shortly thereafter. She did not get enormous support, and I am, in significant measure, responsible for that.
Okay, so I don't agree with that. You are only further stigmatizing rape if you try to protect a victim's name. Why should the accused have their names dragged through the mud, but the purported victim just does not have to face that same accountability? So if you want to bring a criminal case, right, obviously you don't technically decide whether or not to bring a criminal case. But if you want to push criminal charges against people, then, yeah, you should be named. You should not be allowed to just be neutral. And saying that this is something special, then you're essentially arguing that rape deserves a high stigma. You're creating that high stigma by trying to keep rape victims' names anonymous. That's what you're perpetuating. Want to push criminal charges against people, and the people accused of heinous crimes such as this, they get named, then the victim needs to be named as well.
The media came to me and asked to film the trial, and the idea fascinated me.
What you are seeing when you see a jury trial is the most vital aspect of direct democracy in America today.
Judge Young was entertaining the idea of having cameras in the courtroom. There had never been a nationally televised rape trial in the United States before. CNN hadn't been around that long. The whole experience was brand new.
We're really happy to be here at the start of something very special in television journalism.
And we're happy that you're here with us to watch the news channel as the news goes on.
I tried to foresee the various issues that would come up. I sat down with the media beforehand to...
Okay, if you want to go public by testifying at a trial, you can't expect that your name is going to be suppressed. And if you want to go public with something, for example, if you want to be the whistleblower, even the whistleblower, whose name we're not allowed to say on YouTube, and on Facebook and throughout much of big tech, you want to go forward with such a serious accusation, then you should expect scrutiny of yourself, your own motives, your own character, your own standing. That's the way the real world operates.
Go over the protocol. I required that if they were going to film, there be a single camera. And they would film every day, every piece of evidence, start to finish. I'm all for transparency. I realized that cameras in the courtroom had a true public benefit. So that was the choice I made.
It's been a very public rape.
So everything that has a benefit also has a downside. There are no choices that we make that don't have any downside. There are no actions, there are no words, there are no pursuits. Everything has a downside. So it's a matter of weighing up the upside and the downside and trying to make the best judgment you can. But there's no such thing as a choice without a downside.
Trial. Widely discussed trials.
Most unusual and provocative rape trial.
Live courtroom coverage.
We'll have live coverage.
An extraordinary look into the American criminal justice system.
February 23, 1984. So 11 months after the rape trial begins. Just nationally televised on CNN, which is only about 3 years old at this point.
All right, I'll see you later, Harry. Thank you.
Good morning. Suffering declining ratings. This is a real ratings boom.
Can you tell us what
CNN.
It is, what it means?
It's really for them to speak to, okay?
This
sorry.
Defense attorneys being interviewed.
I'm not going to predict. Let's just see what a jury does. You never know what a jury does in this business.
Jurors are kept sequestered as part of the trial.
At 11:17 a.m., February 23rd, gavel-to-gavel coverage of the trials went into the homes of cable subscribers in New Bedford, Fall River, and Dartmouth. Here, at the heart of the courthouse, is where Judge William Young will preside and where juries will decide what happened that night at Big Dan's almost a year ago.
Trials are about real events and real people. The whole idea is to uncover the truth as to what happened.
So if this behavior is just completely unfathomable for you, you need to watch nature documentaries such as The Rise of the White Race.
Everybody falls completely silent.
It's on YouTube, it's on Amazon, Rise of the White Race. Stunning, stunning photography. Compelling story, compelling characters.
They are looking for chimpanzees who are their neighbors, who are strangers, and who are the enemy. If they're going to do that, and if they are smart, they'll do it in big groups. There's some big chimpanzee communities in this part of the forest. It's not just Ngogo chimpanzees.
They're all on the same page. And somehow, some way, communicating to each other. But hey, it's time. We're about to go. But how they're communicating among themselves, between themselves, is a big black hole. That's where maybe nonverbal communication might be involved. Kilometer or more until they reach the boundary of their territory.
If they hear a lot of voices, they know there are strangers nearby, and it's risky. And depending how many chimpanzees are present on one side or the other, it might be the Ngogo chimpanzees who run away. This time, they're outnumbered, and the best thing for them to do is get out of there.
So why do men rape? Well, why do male chimpanzees rape? Why do dogs rape? Why is rape rampant in nature? Back to this Netflix documentary series, Trial by Media, Big Dance.
At this time, in this courtroom, you 16 men and women are the judges of the facts. Let me take a moment now to confer with counsel. Counsel?
It was an intense moment, and the intensity was not lost upon anybody present in the courtroom.
We all know that this case has something to do with what happened at Big Dan's Tavern in New Bedford on March the 6th, 1983. You weren't there. I wasn't there. I'm a prosecutor. This is an opportunity that the court has allowed me to give you something of an outline.
I wanted to prepare the jury for testimony from numerous witnesses, the defendants, and most importantly, the victim in this case.
She tell you she went in? Asked for some change for some cigarettes? Got them? She'll also tell you she bought herself a drink. What she's going to tell you is that on her way out, leaving Big Dan's, she was grabbed.
Okay, so it's not a good idea to go to bars alone to buy a drink if the bar is filled with low IQ people, if you're the only woman in the bar, right? Don't hang out in bars where you're the only woman there. Don't go alone to a bar. Buy cigarettes and have a drink if you don't know people at the bar, if you don't know the reputation of the bar, if you don't know the community, if you don't know who you're hanging out with. Why put yourself unnecessarily at risk? If you put yourself in a bar filled with dangerous people, you are not to blame. You don't bear the moral culpability of rape. But you're certainly facilitated, you played a role in facilitating that.
So these two men, Daniel Silva and Joseph Villa, each took a side of that woman and dragged her along the floor back to the pool table. They were followed by Victor Raposo and John Cadero, with Virgilio and Jose Medeiros not far behind. And that they threw her onto the pool table. All this time, she was crying, she was screaming, she was...
So do chimps stop when another chimp cries? No, it means nothing to them. right? So human beings have the capacity to be more moral than that, but they still have the same basic urges and drives that chimpanzees have. So if you're shocked by this human male behavior by these six Portuguese nationals, then watch Rise of the Mighty Reds.
The long-term ramifications of this behavior and the subsequent killings that we would observe were the farthest things from my mind. A lot of this was all try to piece the puzzle together. And it wasn't long after he started to see hunts. Why do they hunt? One old idea is that they hunt when they're hungry, when there isn't a lot of fruit around. But as things turn out, it's exactly the opposite.
I vividly remember one time when I decided...
So these apes, they don't just hunt for food. They hunt for variety. They hunt for excitement. They hunt for something different. Part of the reason why so many men hunt women.
I'm going to follow a group of some of the males. And they heard red colobus monkeys.
Gets
out on a small branch and he's momentarily trying to decide what to do. Another chimpanzee comes from an adjacent tree.
So just like these Portuguese nationals, they saw a monkey, they seized her and they shared her, not morally exculpating them, not taking them off the hook. But this is wired in male nature. Doesn't mean that they are destined to live it out, but it's in the hard wiring.
Jumps onto the other end of the bough, runs at the monkey from behind, grabs him.
We got one.
I was standing maybe 15 feet from them, watching this. Great male chimpanzees, each took an arm or a leg, and they literally started drawing and quartering this monkey.
So when was the last time you felt unsafe? So for me, I can't even remember. It would have been months and months and months ago. Perhaps the last example I can think of, about a year ago, when some urban youths rolled up on me. But for women, there are times when they feel unsafe virtually every day because women are a much more physically vulnerable species. So I think we can more clearly understand what happened at Big Dan's by understanding how chimpanzees work, how apes work.
Here's a leg. It's yours.
Meat seems to play an important role in the formation and maintenance of social bonds. They share meat, but they don't share it randomly. They tend to share it with their close associates.
It's quite selective, and one of the things that Bartok would do is he would selectively share pieces of meat with other individuals, not everybody, one of his buddies, one of his friends.
When I try to make sense of things that are beyond my ken, I turned to people much smarter than me, such as Greg Cochran, and he just made a blog post. Deng Xiaoping once quoted the old proverb, "It doesn't matter whether a cat is black or white, if it catches mice, it is a good cat." He was endorsing what worked capitalism in that case. By 2020 standards, that is a profoundly un-American statement. The only thing that matters is whether the cat is black or white. And Greg Cochran takes the COVID-19 pandemic very seriously. He thinks that this is a major, major story, a major issue, major challenge, and that it's going to kill tens of thousands of people. Also has a blog post here, time dilation. I've noticed that people's sense of time, including my own, is all messed up. Comparison, in the United States, the number of COVID-19 deaths has gone from about 300 to 95,000 in 2 months. The 1918 flu, first noticed on March 11 at Fort Riley, maybe a few hundred deaths in the spring of 1918, really took off in September with 12,000 deaths 6 months later, not 2 months later. Looks as if COVID-19 has a higher R-naught, meaning more infectious than 1918 influenza when allowed to run free. While transportation and movement are considerably faster today than in 1918, the idea that it must not really be very infectious, since it's only infected 4% of the United States in 2 months, not very infectious compared to what? Greg Cochran writes, so far COVID-19 has mostly not infected a terribly high percentage of the population, the exception of some places in Lombardy, where it's likely reached saturation of more than 60%, in New York City about 20%, Spain 5%, Major League Baseball employees 0.75%, Indiana 2.8%. Percentage infected in the United States has to be lower than in Spain, I guess something like 3%. So far 80,000 dead out of that 3%. What can we expect? A, we let it rip, and B, herd immunity is at 70%. People arguing that it has already spread very far and has a very low mortality were wrong. Obviously wrong. Sometimes people are saying something not altogether crazy, like saying we could achieve herd immunity at a fairly low percentage of infection. We make significant social changes, such as mask distancing, that interfere with viral transmission and stuck with those changes indefinitely. People usually leave out those behavior change details and suggest that soon we will all be dancing in the streets, swinging, swaying, records playing. Well, they're saying that a more complete analysis predicts 60% instead of 70%. Mostly they're just saying that herd immunity has to be possible at low incidence because it's just got to be the same reason they knew that COVID-19 was just another flu. Swedish government is saying that Stockholm is close to herd immunity. They are lying. The numbers in Lombardy falsify this. Go ahead, explain that Italians are special, not subject to the same principles as other human populations. These low numbers show that we've controlled the spread of COVID-19 to a significant degree, but we surely seem to be getting ready to stop doing so, stop controlling the spread. Guess what happens then? And we do now have significant uptick in infections and deaths as we have reduced social distancing and we have reduced the lockdown.
To divide a big monkey in half and then he hands half of it to Hare. Hare would later turn around and help Bartok. Bartok plays the game according to those rules instead of the brute force game. Lofty just never seemed to be able to play the coalitionary game, the meat-sharing and grooming game, in the same fashion that Bartok did. He wasn't as socially skillful as Bartok. Early 1999, when I was here for a pretty extended field season and got to witness for the first time how things changed at the top.
So it's not the strongest apes that have become the most alpha necessarily. It's often apes who are the most adept at building coalitions. Anyway, back to this Netflix documentary, Trial by Big Media, Big Dan. Newport, Massachusetts.
And it went on.
The prosecutor has to prove the case. A defendant in our system doesn't have to prove anything. That's always a challenge.
So I think the Anglo-Saxon style of justice can work reasonably well in an Anglo-Saxon society, but can an Anglo-Saxon style of justice work effectively in a society that is no longer Anglo-Saxon?
Women have a responsibility by their words and by their behavior to say no.
There's more than one way to tell a story. So I was prepared for an effort by the defense to undermine the credibility of the victim.
Whatever she and Daniel Sylvia were doing, they were doing because they wanted to do it. He thought in his mind and his heart, there was a consensual act between two adults.
You may very well say sex is a private activity, and it very well is. But just because John Cadero commits it in Big Dan's in front of several people does not make him guilty of aggravated rape.
I suggest we've all had the experience of going to a party and having someone come up to us and say, it's a full moon now. I think I'm going to act a little crazy tonight.
We knew this was going to be difficult. But now I was in it. Bob Kane was in it. We had work to be done.
It was incredible to see the amount of media near the Fall River Courthouse. I mean, it was a little bit nuts. Every day the trial's on, you're writing a story.
There is a lag time prior to the absorption in the bloodstream so that there will be an increase, perhaps 15 to 20 minutes following that last
day. She did not appear drunk.
Did she slur her words?
No, she did not.
Did you see her walk?
Yes, she could ambulate well without having any difficulties at all.
And did she speak to you for some time?
Yes.
It takes a lot for people to tune in, but in this case, people wanted to know. They wanted to hear it. They wanted to get all the information about it.
And she also had a bluish, bruised print of four fingers on the inner part of her left thigh.
That he was sorry for what...
So, maybe the Anglo-Saxon judicial system is no longer best suited for America. Maybe we need something like the French system, which is ruled by judges rather than ruled by jury. I remember serving on a jury, and the black defendant really intoxicated when he'd been pulled over. He blew blood alcohol limits way above what was legal, but the two black women on the jury would not convict the young black man, no matter the evidence. So not so convinced anymore after that experience that the Anglo-Saxon system is going to work for current America. I'm tending towards thinking that the French judicial system, where lawyers have much less sway, where judges rule, that's a much better system for America of the 21st century.
What he did, he did. And he was drunk at the time, but that was no excuse for him.
She was somewhat hysterical, in a state of shock. I was under the impression that she couldn't believe that this had happened to her.
He stood up, he unbuckled his pants, and he lowered them to his knees.
And at that point, sir, did you make any observation of Daniel Sylvia?
Yes, I did.
What did you observe?
I really enjoyed it. I'll step right to the TV.
Look at that face.
Yes, I did.
And what did you see on that face?
Fear. I've never seen anybody that scared in my life before. It's like a soap opera, you know? They probably make a movie out of this, right?
Defendant John Cordero takes the witness stand.
I went by and I said, you gonna give a blowjob? He started up. I said, you ain't gonna bite it, are you? She just looked at me and laughed, right? So I took it out. I put it, like, it went down to the side of her mouth. I brought it back. She opened the mouth and took it.
I love General Hospital, but I haven't seen it since the case began.
Every day during the trial, people would talk about what they saw yesterday on television or what they heard on the radio. And then they would voice their opinion about this case.
In restaurants and bars, strong opinions are being voiced about what is right and wrong, and about what rape is.
Okay, so what's right and wrong in the animal kingdom among the chimpanzees? Here's an excerpt from Rise of the Warrior Ape.
Weya was still the alpha male, but Lofty decided to make a bid. He was ready to challenge.
The alpha male really does a lot better than the other high-ranking males. And dominance rank indeed does have a strong effect on reproductive success. Lofty, he was a physical specimen, very muscular.
He first had to beat a few other males, including Bartok, who was still number two. There was this climactic moment. Lofty and Bartok were both in this dense vegetation where I couldn't see very well what was going on. And then Bartok emerged from this vegetation, his supreme self-confidence shattered. After that, he was number three. Lofty had just made himself number two. He then started a challenge of Moya that took several months.
So Moya starts out as the alpha male, and then by the end of the documentary, he's about number 32 in the hierarchy. Back to the Netflix documentary, Trial by Big Media, Big Dad.
I don't call that rape.
But it was right for them to do that?
To an extent, yes.
Why?
Because she asked for it.
Whether she asked for it or not, that's not the point of the trial, I think. In my own opinion, I think.
So I obviously don't come to this story or any story with a blank slate. And I do have a streak in me that fears women, and I have a streak in me that hates women. Now, I also have a streak in me that respects women and likes women and loves women. Complicated mess. I'm a hot mess. But I remember when this story came out in 1983, this mother of my best friend, she knew a little bit about my dark side, and so she said to me, "Oh, you probably think she asked for it, didn't you?" So, yeah, even then I was pretty open with my misogyny. I was just doing a video on Sunday going through my senior year of high school, the yearbook, and various women in the yearbook noted my misogyny. Remember, there were letters to the editor of the Sierra Sun, the college newspaper that I edited for 1 year. There was a letter noting my misogyny. So I have been afflicted by a fear and hatred of women. And I had to get help for it. Eventually, I went to a 12-step program, got some help for it, serving as part of my sex addiction. And now I'm completely free. No, of course I'm not completely free. That fear and that hatred is just under the surface. I'm not some pure, you know, ascendant spiritual master here preaching this story. I come with my own baggage. On the other hand, I don't want to be all, you know, believe all women. You know, men are jerks. You know, women are, you know, pure creatures. That's delusional. I want to live in reality, and part of living in reality is recognizing my own sickness and admitting my own sickness.
They're guilty of committing that rape.
I think that if these gentlemen were tried by their peers and found adjudged guilty, I think they should serve their time like any other citizen or whatever.
Maybe the girl is supposed to go to jail too.
Enough evidence there to say that she's the guilty one.
She should be put away too.
It went back and forth like that for weeks.
Which, it's very unfair what they did.
It blew up. It was a soap opera nationwide. It was something that people followed.
Here, the victim will take the stand to tell her version of what happened that night. Prosecutors say it is extremely difficult to get a jury to bring in a guilty verdict unless they hear from the alleged victim.
She knew the day of reckoning was coming.
This was going to have a profound impact upon her life and that of her family.
A profound impact that she chose to go through with. Right. No one put a gun to her head and said that she had to testify. She chose to testify.
This was the first time people were going to see her, and we wanted to protect against that.
To protect her identity, Judge William Young instructed that the woman not be photographed by television or other cameras.
They couldn't take photographs of her in the courthouse, but in terms of the parking lot and whatnot, that might be a different thing. We gave her this big floppy hat. It was a way of protecting her identity right up to the very time when she entered the courthouse. This was no longer preparation for trial, no longer these talks establishing a rapport. This was the moment.
Right hand. You solemnly swear that the evidence that you shall give to the court and to the jury, the matters now depending between the Commonwealth and the defendants at the bar, so help you God.
I do.
It was important for the jury to understand we're not getting some sort of performance here. We're getting the real deal. We're getting a genuine young lady who is trying against the odds to give her story.
Proceed. How old are you?
22.
When were you born?
March 28, 1961.
Where were you born?
New Bedford.
Where were you raised?
New Bedford.
What schools did you attend?
Ashley, Namandan, New Bedford High.
She had the will to focus upon the job at hand.
Please tell us your name.
Cheryl Arujo.
Might you spell your last name?
A-R-A-U-J-O.
We tried hard not to show the victim, but nobody thought about her name.
When the woman involved took the stand, cameramen were not allowed to photograph her. And while the woman's face was not shown, her name and address were heard by the audience.
The name of the woman who says she was raped was published and broadcast on some stations.
It went on the air. All of it. All of it.
The live news coverage, in a sense, has backfired because as the flow of testimony unraveled, the name of the rape victim became a matter of public record.
Why would you expect that the prime mover behind a criminal case is going to be kept anonymous? All the men accused in rape cases, their names are out there. Why should the accuser get anonymity? I don't believe that.
After her name was printed, there was an increase in fear on her part. There was a tremendous amount of animosity toward Cheryl.
So if she hadn't been told that her name would get out there, then she was badly advised. And if she thought that she could testify at a trial and her name wouldn't get out there, then she was foolish.
In the community. Because now she had been named, and it was not too difficult to figure out where she lived. She had two little girls. She was very concerned about it.
I was told by Michael asked me to put the kids to bed before I went.
And what did you do in putting the kids to bed?
Well, I had to put their pajamas on and wash them, brush their teeth, put the nightlight on, give the little one her medicine.
What kind of medicine is that?
She takes medicine for her lungs.
Okay, I want to go to Tucker Carlson.
Good evening and welcome to a Tucker Carlson Tonight Live special. Months from now, if and when we're finally able to assess this pandemic rationally and honestly, it'll be clear that it was mostly a disaster for the old and the sick. 30-year-olds in Brooklyn have made the most noise, flooding the internet with their neuroses. but it's old people who've really suffered. About a third of all deaths in this country so far have occurred in long-term care facilities. We told you a lot about the tragedy unfolding in New York. As of tonight, almost 6,000 nursing home residents have died there after Governor Andrew Cuomo forced facilities to admit infected patients. But it's not only happening in New York. In New Jersey, Connecticut, and Massachusetts, for example, deaths in nursing homes account for more than half of the statewide totals. So if you're old and in a facility, this virus has been genuinely dangerous. But the real story is even worse than that, thanks to bad policies. Many nursing homes have banned all visits from relatives, even those who have tested negative for the coronavirus. That means for millions of aging Americans, lockdowns equal suffering alone, marooned in isolation, away from children and grandchildren, often in the final days of their lives. It's hard to imagine anything sadder than that, but in fact, there is something sadder. No visitors means no real supervision. No one who cares about the elderly can check in and see how they're doing. This is an invitation to the most awful kinds of abuse. Take a look at this video. It's from the Westwood Nursing Center in Detroit. We warn you, and we don't say this lightly, it is highly upsetting. We think you should see it because it's real. It goes on like that for 90 seconds, but we'll spare you. The monster throwing those punches is 20 years old. The helpless resident he's smashing in the face is 75. Westwood Nursing Center says it had no idea the assault even happened. The video wound up on social media, apparently was posted by the proud attacker himself. People saw it and called police. They arrested him. He's in jail tonight. Police will not tell us his name. It's not clear why he deserves to be famous. What is clear is that the Westwood Nursing Center was a scary place even before this assault took place. A 2019 Medicare inspection of the facility found that a resident had vomited on a curtain. 2 weeks later, Westwood staff still hadn't replaced or even cleaned it. Imagine all that the inspectors didn't find. We'll help you imagine. This video is from a nursing home outside Peoria, Illinois. It was recorded in 2015. An elderly man beaten to the ground by a staff member.
This video is from a care facility in Creve Coeur. Watch the 84-year-old man. He comes into the room with his walker and tries to get something out of a drawer. Police say the caregiver, Ernestine Cobbins, struggles with him and then throws him to the floor. Fortunately, he was not seriously injured. Officers reviewed the tape. Cobbins was charged with third-degree elderly abuse.
Imagine doing that to a man with a walker. The woman who did it, who committed that crime, is free today. In fact, she is still in the healthcare business. You can look up her LinkedIn page online. We just did about 10 minutes ago, and she looks perfectly content in her picture. And then there are these three nursing home employees in North Carolina. They're accused of staging fistfights between dementia patients for their own amusement.
They uncovered two separate incidents. In one, 32-year-old Marilyn McKee is accused of physically assaulting a 73-year-old resident, pushing her into a room while 20-year-old Tanasia Tyson and 26-year-old Tanisha Jordan filmed the encounter and did not help. In another incident, all three are accused of encouraging a fight between two residents, ages 70 and 73. Not only did the workers not stop the fight, they filmed it. The staff members reportedly captured on the video saying, "Punch her in the face."
That happened just this fall. From what we can tell, none of these women is currently in jail tonight. Apparently, the crime wasn't serious enough. It's not like they tried to open a gym in New Jersey or dared to walk on dry sand in Los Angeles. And by the way, these are not isolated incidents. Far from it. Consider the following headlines. They are all from last year. Florida woman accused of raping man with dementia at nursing home. Nursing assistant who raped patient sentenced to 12 years in prison. Everett man has history of raping patients, prosecutors say. Hillcrest Nursing Home faces $50 million lawsuit over rape of elderly woman. And then in Seattle, a nursing assistant was arrested after being caught on camera repeatedly sexually assaulting a patient. Once again, the nursing home didn't even know it happened. They didn't detect the crime because no one was watching. The victim's family was suspicious, so they put a camera in the room. In Texas, a nurse called Billy Shimmermer was arrested for murdering patients. Police say he killed more than 20 elderly people before anyone noticed. Again, all of that happened in a single year, last year, 2019. So what's happening in nursing homes right now? Well, we don't really know. That's the point. Family and loved ones aren't allowed in to see. Chances are they would be heartbroken if they knew. How did this tragedy happen? It wasn't by accident. Our politicians did it. They did it to the most vulnerable people in our society, the ones who have earned the greatest respect, the Americans who actually did build this country. Now our helplessly elderly are locked in stinking cells, cut off from the only ones who love them. Some of them, as we said, are raped and beaten. Thousands and thousands have died alone. They don't deserve this, and the rest of us don't deserve the leaders whose neglect and bad judgment made it possible. Charles Kamesey is a professor of theological and social ethics at Fordham University. He's the author of the book Resisting Throwaway Culture, and he joins us tonight. Professor, thanks so much for coming on. It does seem like I understand the reasoning behind wanting to isolate people in nursing homes, but it does seem like a thoughtful politician would wonder what it would be like to be locked away alone with no one visiting you. So why couldn't we test family before they go visit their loved ones in nursing homes?
Tucker, this is bigger than one politician. It is a monster issue. Speaking as an ethics professor, I just want to make this really global point. I think a lot about historical moments, history calling us, yes, to act on behalf of the most vulnerable, civil rights, pro-life movement. History is calling us again, Tucker. Nobody can watch that intro that you just did and not hear the voice of history calling us to act. The pandemic is forcing us to look at places we don't want to look. And by God, there are good nursing homes out there. We don't want to say otherwise.
Sure.
But now that we know the scope of the problem and the gravity of the problem, the only question is, what are we going to do about it? What are we going to do about it?
You know, you look, we checked this afternoon because the more I thought about it, the more upset I got. And so many of the people arrested last year, in fact, every single one we could track down was free. No one was serving a jail sentence. And you think of the things that people go to jail for. What does that say?
Well, in my book, Resisting Throwaway Culture, I try to argue that what's behind this is we have throwaway people. We have prenatal children we have throwaway. We have sick people, yeah, we throw away through euthanasia. We have people we throw away through hookup culture and through in our jails and prison systems. This is the next one. This is literally a throwaway culture. We put people away, so we give plausible deniability about our own death and dying and those of our family members, so we don't have to think about it. Now we're forced to look at it. And this is one of the silver linings. There aren't many of the pandemic, but one silver lining is we are now forced to look.
That is such a deep point. So your view is that we ignore end-of-life questions because we don't want to consider the end of our own lives.
I don't need to tell you, Tucker, we have a youth-worshipping, death-denying culture that tries to revel in the moment. And especially as we move away from transcendent views about our ultimate reality, we tend to live in that moment even more. And our death becomes that much more frightening. And especially those of our family members, too. And we push it off literally to the places you just highlighted. And now we have to act. Are we going to move to welcome these people back into our homes if we can? Are we going to move to demand from government, Medicare, and Medicaid to actually pay these people who work in these homes a living wage? Are we going to move as media to cover these stories? You're leading with this today, but 50% of the deaths, the Washington Post said 50% of the deaths from COVID-19 were people who were in nursing homes or other long-term care facilities. You would think that 50% of the coverage would then cover those stories, but it's not even close to that. So thank you for leading with it tonight, but we actually need the media to step up and report out these stories.
Why is that? It almost seems like people are admitting they don't care about the deaths of older people who are shunted away in these facilities, but then they're, you know, focused on the relatively small percentage of people who were younger. I mean, it just seems so disproportionate to me.
I don't know. Is it too cynical to say that doesn't make a lot of money? I mean, how much money does covering nursing home deaths make media organizations? I mean, it's expensive to do. This is one thing that is really our media has really suffered from, especially investigative reporting. It's expensive to do investigative reporting.
Yeah, it is.
We may not have the resources, especially if we're guided by clicks and advertising revenue.
I think you're right. And I think this is really important, and I think your point about denying our own mortality being at the center of this is absolutely right. Thank you for saying that. Professor, good to see you tonight.
Thanks, Tucker.
Well, for months now, Dr. Anthony Fauci has been one of the most persuasive and powerful voices in favor of the coronavirus lockdowns. Now, suddenly, he seems to have pivoted 180 degrees. He's warning that the lockdowns could hurt people irreparably if they continue. Dave Portnoy noticed this. He thinks it's as weird as we do. He'll react after the break.
Okay, so that young nursing home aide who was beating that gentleman, 75-year-old gentleman, well, there's also a video of him beating a woman.
People listening, Mike Freeman wrote a piece about Russell Wilson where he quoted unnamed players saying he wasn't black enough, that he was too much of a company guy and that sort of thing. Now, Mike disagreed with the statement, but some of the players said that. Is that the same case where, like, why would you hate Russell Wilson?
Well, unfortunately, as I tell my white friends, we as black people, we're never going to be successful, not because of you white people, because of other black people. When you're black, you have to deal with so much crap in your life from other black people. It's a dirty, dark secret. I'm glad it's coming out. It comes out every few years. I wrote a big chapter in my book about it, to be honest with you. I say, you know, when young black kids, you know, when they do well in school, the loser kids tell them, oh, you're acting white. The kids who speak intelligently, they tell them, you're acting white. So it's a dirty, dark secret in the black community. One of the reasons we're never going to be successful as a whole because of other black people. And for some reason, we are brainwashed to think if you're not a thug or an idiot, you're not black enough. If you go to school, make good grades, speak intelligent, and don't break the law, you're not a good black person. And it's a dirty, dark secret, Anthony. I heard Stephen A. talking about it. Listen, I hate to bring white people into our crap, but as a black person, we all go through it when you're successful. You know, it's like one of the reasons a lot of black players go broke is because when you're successful, your friends say, oh, you ain't cool. You ain't down with us anymore. And you end up giving up all your money to these damn losers, and you end up broke again.
Yeah.
But it's a dirty, dark secret in the black community that a lot of black people who are unintelligent, who don't have a success, it's best to knock a successful black person down because they're intelligent, they speak well, they do well in school, and they're successful. And they don't – I mean, think about it.
Well, it's crabs in a barrel, right?
It's crabs in a barrel. And it's the thing that's funny. We're the only race that tell people if you don't have street cred, which, like, that means you've been arrested.
Right.
Like, that's a compliment. We're the only ethnic group who say, hey, if you go to jail, it gives you street cred. It's just typical BS that goes on when you're black, man. Don't waste a lot of time on it, please.
All right, joining us now is first time on Hannity. He is the owner of the Dallas Mavericks and the...
Okay. Wow.
The fact that her name was immediately disclosed, honestly, must be laid at my door. The media's position had uniformly been that the name of the alleged victim would not be disclosed. And that was so universal that I confess I assumed that that would follow in a televised trial. It did not.
Did you guys hear about that 72-year-old man who was having a nice AA meeting on Zoom? Then his naked son comes into the room and stabs him to death. Dwight Powell, 72, of Amityville, New York, stabbed to death while on a Zoom chat with 20 other AA members, stabbed to death by his son, Thomas Scully. And we have to defeat the idea the United States of America is a place.
All right, now, the question is, he's going to get his ass beat. All right, that's what's going on. They're going to get his fat ass beat. All right, now, the question is, by how much? If we want to go do this lethargic kind of stuff and blah, 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 and worry about this, we can get 290, 295 electoral votes and we'll change nothing. If we go and take it to them and talk about what a massive fat failure he is, then we can run away with this thing. And you can defeat, it's not, idea is not just to defeat Trump. You have to defeat Trumpism. You have to defeat the idea that the United States of America is a place and not an idea. And we're all fighting, and it's white people fighting against non-white people and men fighting against women and, I don't know, gay people fighting against non-gay people. It's all bullshit. And it's just, call him on it. The country does not want him back.
Yeah, guys, the United States of America is not a place. So here's a white kid walking down the street, gets mugged, has all his money stolen from him. White woman. And I just got to speak out. I got to use this platform to decry violence against women. God's given me this platform, and I'm going to use it to decry violence against women. Unacceptable. Guys, why are we focused on that which divides us instead of that which unites us? First 18 hours after that beating there by the nursing aide Jaden Hardin, nobody in the mainstream media covered it. It was only a local story out of Detroit. Only Fox covered it. Now the New York Times has a story. So it was kept local until Fox took up the story.
No, guys, but I get the feeling if you ask them this question, or what's 1 + 1 equal, you're going to get 7 different answers. It's okay to say you don't know. That's kind of my point. I don't think anybody really knows the true answers. It's a moving target. It's a disease we've never met with before. But that's why I think at this point you're going to let people, individuals, make decisions for themselves, because nobody knows. The only thing, as I said before, that we absolutely know for certain is if you continue the quarantine, you continue the lockdown, tons of people are going to lose their livelihoods. Those people should have the choice to make a decision rather than depend on things that, listen, Fauci may be the nicest guy in the world, but he said, wear masks, don't wear masks. He said, you know, the lockdown's going to go on indefinitely. We're going to end the lockdown. So it's just tough to really put that much stake in what he's saying when I just don't think he knows. Maybe Trump just got him in a room and shook him. He's like, today you say this. So I don't know. But it's tough to take it seriously when you literally say the exact opposite. And we're not talking months. We're talking days apart. What changed?
So, look, I think your point about not really knowing what the truth is an absolutely fair and important one. And I've certainly been wrong on this show a bunch of different times. But I admit it because I know that people have YouTube and they can check. Fauci comes on and acts like he's always been saying this when 2 days ago he was saying the opposite. Shouldn't he at least acknowledge the change?
Absolutely. And, you know, any politician or anybody in general, I would much prefer somebody. First of all, I have no problem saying, guess what? I don't know. I'd rather that.
Right.
But if you have a strong opinion, say it. And if you're wrong, then say, hey, hand up. I'm the first one. I like to break my arm when I make a mistake. And you know what? American people, they appreciate that. They want to know when you're wrong. I invested in a Chinese company. You probably hate me for it. Baba, it tanked today. There was a revolution. Guess what? I made the wrong move. You have to just say it, own up to it. No one's expecting any human being to be perfect. But when you say a very important statement and act like it never happened and say something different, it raises, you know, everyone's like, what is he doing? I don't know that he's doing it intentionally. But either take a side or say, I don't know, and acknowledge when you make a mistake. That's how you get trust, because right now, I don't trust what he says. I don't know how anybody could. And again, I don't know that's intentional. I just honestly think this thing moves. And if you go, I mean, there's videos of Fauci all through this. He's on different sides, depending on the day, depending on the mood. Like I said, the way the wind blows, and we're making seemingly life-changing decisions for other people based on facts that clearly are not facts.
Well, exactly. So yesterday, Fauci did an interview with Julia Roberts, not the journalist, but the actress. Did that make you trust him more or less?
I mean, there's an element that you'd want your lead doctor in Pandemic not going with a Hollywood starlet, but it doesn't. You know, he's got a believable face. Listen, if he you does. Put him in front of me and I didn't know all the mismatched stuff, I'd be like, I trust him. He looks smart. But I'm paying attention to the words. I wouldn't say talking Julia Roberts. Listen, I like Pretty Woman as much as the next guy, so I'm not going to hold that against him.
I totally agree about the way he looks. When I see Fauci on TV with the sound off, I think, I believe that guy. And he does come off as a nice person. We've interviewed him on this show. It's nothing personal. But I think people have listened so long because he looks like the guy you would listen to. Very smart.
He absolutely looks like an expert. And to be honest, yeah. In every single, question or speech, he sounds like an expert. Like, if they're all one-offs, I'd be like, okay, I'll listen and I'll believe. But now there's enough footage. Everyone's locked inside and they're hanging on what he says. Like, when he goes in front of the Senate and says, if we open too quickly, there's going to be mass damage and death. Those are heavy, heavy words to then go say the exact opposite. In a week later, it's almost the gravity of what he says in the moment. It's almost like he's losing it. He's going to be very careful with the words because, again, what he says, I feel like, is what a lot of states are basing their reopening on. And it changes.
No, that's
so
exactly right.
What information, what model? It's always a moving target. And what we got to remember is, again, I don't think anyone really knows the answer, but it's tough then to tell a business owner, hey, you're going to lose your business because what Fauci said. And the guy's like, well, at what point, what yardstick are we using, or what day are we using what Fauci said?
I think at this point I trust Julia Roberts more. Dave Portnoy, great to see you.
She's very believable. She's a very believable American. That's the team Portnoy. Yeah. At least stand for something and then admit when you're wrong. But Julia Roberts, very, very believable.
Very. Good to see you, man.
You too.
Well, to the extent you think about race at all, and let's hope you don't think about it too much, you probably assume it's determined by your ancestry. But Joe Biden says you're wrong. He says he's the one who decides what race you are.
Lofty was a bully. Kind of bullied his way to the top individually, and his challenge to Moya was him against Moya. Wasn't him plus an ally. He really shook Moya's confidence. And finally, Moya just started to give way to him. I can remember the first day that I saw Moya paint Grunt to Lofty. And when I saw that, I thought, okay, he's done it. He's the alpha male now.
But you can't lead if no one follows you. He'd run around, beat up everybody, and then he'd take off. And he never seemed very secure in his position. You know, feel comfortable being around others and acting like the alpha male. He never really was able to build.
Hey, Gandalf, what's going on, man?
It's been a while. I mean, I just was in an epic Claire stream. It's like the Claire Caw bog of the internet. It swallowed me up today.
So what happened to you? What led you to disengage from the streaming world for a couple of months?
The chaos of this virus and just wanting to just get away from the hysteria for a while, because I sort of wonder if is the streaming world crazier or is the real world crazier with threats of, well, at least at the middle of March when I kind of decided to take a break, you know, there's going to be tanks down the streets and everyone's shut down and you can't leave your house and threatening to arrest people if you go somewhere. I mean, this is the kind of talk people were having. I'm like, I got to make sure I have enough food for a couple months and I just want to pretend none of this is happening and then get back to reading and doing quiet stuff.
and hope the government gives me a check.
Was there anything specific that happened online that led you to leave the online world?
Not really. It was mostly the offline stuff and just like wanting to totally disconnect from everything for a little while, just to take a break. Because the human world, whether online or off, has been insane.
And did it make you happier disengaging from the online world for a couple of months?
Actually, it did in a way. I've been much calmer. Just having very little human interaction. I kind of like it. The only thing I've missed about being in the city is I couldn't go to the library and change some books in and out. But I have plenty to read anyway.
So what have you been doing the past couple of months?
Reading, thinking about some things, reflecting on what's going on. I think the first week or two of the lockdown, I was really depressed. So I just kind of zoned out. Like, I played a lot of video games. One of the rare times I've done that. And then just kind of went back from there and delved into books and was happy as a lark because I'm a huge introvert by nature.
And did you learn anything during this downtime?
About the world or about myself or about a book I read?
About yourself.
I think as I get a little bit older, I think I think it's important to have periods of rest and distance. I think as I get older, I'm very territorial. Very territorial MF-er, I think, on some level. I'm an old man. I'm an old crusty man. I might be in my mid-30s, but I'm a crusty old man on some level. An old soul. And I really felt it. Like, on some level, you appreciate every day you're living. Because, you know, a lot of people have died in this pandemic. It's not just the flu, bro. Although I don't know if it was the apocalyptic event that they were predicting was going to be, but nevertheless, it's been a pretty severe illness, and the government's handled it extremely poorly. It's really sad. It's we're going to live through a pretty harsh collapse, and you just got to try and learn how to be within yourself, and hopefully you're calm enough to live through the other side.
And what were you talking about with Claire Corr?
Well, the usual thing about, always got to go back to secular Quranism, even though we were talking about Church of Entropy's approach to morality, which I think is a very intuitive and scientific approach. Claire kind of struggles with wanting to get too deeply into it because she's very insistent on her point of view about God. Even though point of view about God consistently has logical errors, that doesn't really seem to bother Claire. I mean, I kind of admire that Claire is so bullheaded. Claire is really amazing. She sticks to the same story no matter what. I mean, she had one follower for a while, John Vance, who's now moved on somewhere else. And she keeps plugging away. I mean, she's been at it 10 years trying to get her second secular Quranist. It's some level, I kind of admire the dogged pursuit of that first follower.
And
meanwhile,
what is her perspective on God?
Well, she doesn't really believe in God, which is funny because she wants to, but at the same time, she thinks that the God of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam is the real God because it's converted the most people and therefore is the most powerful and most well-known and therefore it's the right place from which to derive laws for society, which is a very cynical and utilitarian argument.
And are there any time spent stamps in your discussion with Claire that you'd recommend perhaps I play on this show?
Oh, we're going to have to go. That stream just ended, so I don't know if it's actually fully loaded. It ended like 10 minutes ago.
No, it's so fully loaded, so... Is it an hour in? Is it near the end? Is it in the middle? Can you give me an approximation?
I don't have any timestamps off the top of my head because I think I must have fully loaded right before I called you, so I didn't timestamp it yet. Unfortunately, it's well. The funny part is our friend Conops like is just refused to like look at certain realities. Like Conops is insistent on like cherry picking anecdotes. And not wanting to look at pretty broad secular trends in terms of how things work, whether it's geopolitics, history, science, philosophy, religion. It's really, Conops is fun. I enjoy talking with him, but it's very remarkable watching people be very stubborn in their beliefs for different reasons. Claire, for the prestige of her own ideology. Conops, because I think he has a socially informed persona that he wants to keep as some sort of know-it-all, above-it-all European liberal, or I think something like that. And then we had somebody else I don't think you're aware of. Do you know who Domingo is?
Not sure.
Yeah, Domingo is he's part of the truth community who comes in some of our streams, and he often gives a lot of very detailed information about all sorts of historical scandals, and Conops really didn't want to hear any of it. It's remarkable how people talk past each other and don't really want to hear what the other person is saying and dialogue deeply with ideas. And it just the massive stupidity of everything, both because of the lockdown, by coming back into streaming, watching things decay, is simply awe-inspiring. I mean, I've watched some of your recent streams, and just the behavior you've shown that goes on just regularly and how people react to it is also a sign of it.
What are you referring to particularly?
Well, like the case of that white woman being mugged, or the story of the boxer, jogger type, beating up those people in that psych ward. I mean, and all this just goes on. People just don't seem to care. Like, this behavior just keeps going on, and, like, the ability to socially sanction is declining. And just the endless your clip about that guy from that owns the bar chain, Barstool Sports, talking about how Dr. Fauci's ever-changing story is making it so businesses don't know when or if they can reopen, which is causing more of them to close. I'm like, should we really be trusting these experts if they can't provide a roadmap by which the society can function? And does anyone see that this is a problem? I don't think people are taking it as seriously as they should. And we're being led very badly by people that don't really care about the future of this society. And people seem to be taking it. It's kind of unbelievable.
There's this streamer by the name of Paw Talk who accused me of damaging people's souls because I'm introducing people to dangerous ideas without telling them what stance that they should take with the ideas, without telling them how to think about ideas or books. What do you think about the whole notion that a live streamer could be damaging people's souls by not telling them what sort of stance that they should take towards ideas or towards books?
Well, who is he to say that a live streamer has a certain moral obligation? Who is he as a live streamer to say that you as a live streamer have that obligation? Upon what authority does he say that? See, I don't think any of these people think that through, much less make a moral case for why their interpretation of what is moral or not moral to talk about or to take a position on is that way.
And so Paul Talk subscribes to the zombie bite theory of information, that there's information out there such as videos or books or even arguments or just a collection of facts or a theory that has the potential to bite people like a zombie and then turn them into automatons. So saying that Paul Talk was arguing that I radicalize a lot of people through these streams. I don't believe in the zombie bite theory of information, that there's a video or book that just bites people and turns them into automatons or radicalizes them. I don't believe that information is assimilated that way. I believe that people seek out information that supports their own pre-existing beliefs, and then they may progress a little bit further, but only in directions that they want to go. What is your opinion on the zombie bite theory of information?
Well, I think that is way too simplistic. I think your view is more correct. I mean, most people are NPCs, probably 8 out of 10 people, really don't have a sustained internal monologue, so they will seek out confirmation biases in whatever books or videos they choose to consume. In my case, I most people who talk to me, I'm definitely not an NPC. I'll give an example. I've read David Irving. I've read MK by AH. I didn't like the Austrian Corporal before that. The two books which I read, which supposedly would turn me into a lover of the man, made me hate him all the more, but in a much more nuanced way. So I'm not a zombie. I discovered more. If you had given me MK, and if you had given me David Irving's book, I would have had a much more nuanced and much more critical view of the Austrian Corporal than any mainstream historian would have had. Because I'm like, my God, this guy was a disaster. He was a bohemian idiot. And putting such a histrionic loser in charge of such a once noble country was bound to lead to a disaster, a conflagration which killed tens of millions of people. And for what? So that Europe could be flat on its back and the land of my ancestors could be a vassal of NATO and a place that's run for people not of its own for all sorts of interests? I mean, how terrible is it? I mean, how people like O.V., another one of the streamers in my sphere, and all these other people could look at this guy as some, like, paragon to want to copy. I'm like, look at the results of history. Look at his behavior. Look at the miscalculations he made within days of becoming chancellor, for heaven's sakes. Unbelievable just how people are willing to follow a lost cause because the LARP is, like, some, I guess, a Jew hater or something for whatever reason. Like, I'm certainly aware of these kind of questions, but I'm not, like, consumed with hate about it.
The Big Guy Kayla tweets, shocked to hear of Simon Harris's passing. He was an extremely warm, kind, and intelligent man. So he was a dissident right live streamer, an acolyte of Kevin MacDonald, and apparently he has died. So, Andolf, what do you think about the idea that YouTube's algorithm radicalizes people?
Oh, I don't know if that's so true. I mean, I think what's really radicalizing people isn't YouTube's algorithm. It's just the fact that society is in decline and people are really scared for the future. So they're looking to ideas outside the mainstream of all different persuasions to find explanations for things. Because the mainstream narrative that everything's hunky-dory doesn't conform with the facts of people's everyday struggles. I mean, it's between what the tastemakers, the academics, the media, the corporations, and the government say is one thing, and the reality of lived existence is quite another, and the cognitive dissonance keeps growing, and the available surfeit of ideologies within the Overton window has ever less explanatory power.
So what were the primary things you were thinking about during your 2 months offline?
I'll admit I was thinking a lot about death. For a little while.
And did you come to any realizations?
Life is short, and you have to perform your mission. And my mission is to be someone who helps educate people for social, cultural, and political reform of the kind that will lead to a better civilization. And if I help convert a few people to have a more philosophically wise and scientifically literate and culturally open but fair society, I've done a good job with whatever time I was granted in this life.
So do you have any plans going forward that you would feel free to share with us?
I have some plans. I don't know if I would share them totally. I mean, I would like to do a new show and maybe do some more serious teaching on a number of subjects. Like, I need to get my own website, which I kind of only half finished, done. And I think it's time for people like me, an academic who could probably never find a job because I'm not going to be a toady for the establishment, but neither am I going to be someone who just hates them for no reason and, you know, is some ne'er-do-well malcontent. I think it's just time that someone like me just starts, you know, teaching what I know. I've spent a lifetime just studying and reading and devouring books and trying to see things from multiple perspectives. I have a pretty unique and nuanced take on reality that I think can help people illuminate the darkness.
Now, what was the benefit to you in going on this Claire Core stream? Like, where did you gain a benefit?
Well, the benefit I gain is continuing to sharpen my ability to watch other people's debating and discussing strategies and figuring out how to parry bad faith arguments, understand dead ends and loops that people want to go into, and all the while doing this, press on with ideas. Because I think of all the people I've met on the internet who are, you know, I guess, quote unquote, thought leaders, I think the best I've seen so far is Jen Sharp. I think her ideas are top notch. I can't recall either in her blog or the streams I've seen her in make a bad argument. I've never seen her make a bad argument. So, I mean, and I look at the solidity of her thought and I'm like, okay, I'll follow that, because it's, and a lot of her views kind of jive with mine. I mean, I was kind of on her same wavelength before I even met her, and I really like the elegance. She puts very complex ideas together in a very compelling framework.
And for someone who doesn't know Jen, how would you describe her?
Well, there's a lot of crap said about her, so you got to get through that. But she's actually a very... very kind, benevolent person who really just lives her life just to want to teach science, math, and philosophy, and that's all she really cares about. And she tries to explain stuff, and she's treated as insane for trying to come up with a model to explain quantum mechanics. And I'm like, well, trying to explain quantum mechanics is extremely important because it's the frontier of physics, and she probably does it better than anybody else I've seen. And you know, I can validate it myself insofar as when I was a kid growing up in Chicago, I used to do summer programs at Fermilab, the big particle accelerator here. And some of the themes and issues Jen was talking about were things that all these high-paid scientists were dreaming about years ago. And then Jen comes up with explanations that are profound, elegant, and yet very simple at the same time. And it's like, how did all these really intelligent people not figure it out?
Okay, great. I think I'm going to move on here in a couple of minutes. Are there any important under-news stories that you'd like to mention, important stories that are just barely getting mentioned in the news?
Well, I think it's really amazing that, I mean, this is a commentary on just events. Isn't it amazing that they continue to put Joe Biden out there? I mean, the comments he made on the Breakfast Club, how you're not a real black person if you don't vote for me, and like how people aren't calling him out for this and people are taking it seriously. I mean, the man clearly doesn't have a mind. It's like, why aren't people talking the obvious truth that Joe Biden belongs in a nursing home? And yet that is a serious presidential contender. I mean, if you look at their money, which is tied up with all sorts of weird gas company money laundering in Ukraine and even bigger piles of money from China at a time when there's a lot of saber rattling about China, could it be that Biden is an agent for something else? The fact that there aren't more people asking those pretty obvious questions is a meta critique of the public mind and where the news is, that I wonder why more people aren't making it.
Okay, Gandalf, good to catch up with you. I know you just did like a 3-hour live stream, so I'll let you go for now and bring you back on the show again when you're ready.
Ciao. It was a pleasure to say hello to you and hello to everyone else, and have a great Shabbat tomorrow.
Okay, thanks, Gandalf. Take care, man.
Okay, bye-bye.
The kind of network and other adult males.
Bartok seemed to size up the situation. Lofty just beat Moya. I can do that.
This is from Rise of the Warrior Apes. It's a documentary on Amazon and YouTube. Excellent. It's filmed in Uganda.
When Moya gave in to Lofty, Bartok started to challenge Moya. And he won. So he became number two, and Moya became number three. But Moya and Bartok stayed allies. once he'd become number two, pretty quickly he just decided, well, I should be the alpha male. Lofty was someone who kind of bullied his way to the top. Bartok was more of a political tactician.
Yeah, so it's not the strongest ape that makes it to the top. All right, let me play here a video that Lip
when I did the Darfur movie, it's the only movie about the genocide in Darfur, and the president of Darfur is right now still the president. And George Clooney did a weak documentary about it. My movie's 10 times better, right? So he and Brad Pitt and Matt Damon and all that fuckers completely ignored my movie when I needed to push that movie forward because it would help the genocide. It could bring attention to the cause to stop the massacres in Darfur where 400,000 children and women got hacked in fucking pieces. And the fucking pieces of shit, like Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie and George Clooney, they do all the fucking charity stuff as long as they're getting all the press write-ups about it so they can buy another fucking cast in Africa. Right, so that is the most bullshit business with bullshit idiots, one after the other, lined up behind each other.
Okay, that's Ut Bol, the movie director who shoots things on a very tiny budget and doesn't exactly shoot scenes many times. He produces, what's a nice way of saying trash?
He's not the biggest male. He never was among the biggest. But Bartok knew who to make friends with. And so he made friends with the big guys, and that worked to his advantage.
From the documentary Rise of the Wire.
He groomed selectively with others, sort of to build these bonds with those others.
He did the same thing with hair. He still had Mwea. And he did it to some other male chimpanzees, too. Lofty now had the problem that he had this other male who was building that kind of alliance network. So it was not just going to be him against Bartok.
So friends of mine who are really smart love this documentary because they see themselves as a Bartok, someone who can build alliances, who can move behind the scenes people, men who aren't like classically good-looking, men who aren't classically alpha, men who aren't particularly strong or possessing high status. They see themselves as potential Bartoks that they can move stealthily behind the scenes to get things done, that you don't have to be the biggest and the strongest, the most obviously alpha, have a tremendous impact on the world. So for many very intelligent but non-alpha males who perhaps think of themselves as sigma males, this documentary is catnip.
He had mostly just himself.
And as a result of that, I think that had a lot to do with him having such a short reign at the top.
Bartok and four males showing that I've got hair behind me, I've got Mwea behind me. So many males jumped on Lofty and beat him up. Lofty really gets beaten by this team of other males, and after that, Bartok was the alpha male.
Okay, I want to go back playing some excerpts from this Netflix documentary series, Trial by Media, Big Dad.
It was my mistake, and I regret it extraordinarily.
That's the judge. Regrets that the victim's name became public.
A young Massachusetts mother today resumes testifying in her highly publicized rape case in Fall River.
The woman could face cross-examination by as many as 6 defense lawyers.
We, of course, maintain that no rape was ever committed.
By any of the defendants?
I don't speak for anyone else. Just my client.
she didn't really understand anything about cross-examination. The defense attorney does not have to prove anything. The defense attorney is interested in disproving some of the evidence that may be offered.
Isn't it fair to say that whenever you don't want something to come up, you just say, I don't remember? Isn't that true?
That is not true.
Now, you said to me, I don't remember, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
That was a lie, wasn't it?
It was not a lie.
You do remember.
In court, she was vilified in every public way possible.
Had you been taking any drugs or medication prior to going to Big Dance that night?
Afterwards?
No. Before?
Before? No.
Marijuana?
No.
You have marijuana in the house?
Do I have it in my house?
Did you have it?
No.
Were you using any drugs at all before you went up there?
Objection.
There was so much victim blaming right from the beginning. Why was she there? What was she doing there? Why would she end up in a place like that?
You wouldn't have gone into the place if it was...
This whole victim-blaming rhetoric is just to try to insulate particularly women from responsibility. So what they call victim-blaming is simply assessing people's level of culpability, responsibility. It's called getting the accused the right to effectively to question their accusers. So it's just basic Anglo-Saxon justice. So whenever you hear rhetoric against victim blaming, it's usually the underlying theme is women should never be held accountable for their choices.
It was boisterous and out of control and the men were acting rowdy, would you?
No, I would not.
You would have turned right around on your heels and walked out, wouldn't you?
I guess.
How could she gauge how many people there were?
Did six men line up waiting for their turn?
I don't really believe I've said that.
What did her ears and her brain witness?
I could hear people laughing and cheering, yelling.
The toll on her soul and psyche had to have been enormous.
When you say to your recollection, do you have a selective memory?
Objection, Your Honor.
The testimony has been graphic, and the defense tactics have been rough. Sometimes it does seem that the alleged victim is on trial.
Feminists monitor.
Of course, if you are going to be the prime instigator behind the case, of course you're on trial too. What, you think you can just make accusations and there'll be no accountability for you, no questioning for you?
During the trial have been critical of the cross-examination.
A rape victim really is placed on trial in a rape trial.
Victims are always placed on trial, so to speak, if they're willing to testify. If you're going to bring accusations that could ruin other people's lives, then yeah, you've got to be placed on trial too.
They have to prove their innocence before they even begin to prove the guilt of the defendant.
It hit me in the pit of my stomach. I know.
The notion of women being held responsible for their choices, that hit her in the pit of her stomach because she hates that idea.
Oh, she's a woman who was hurting. It was very unsettling to
hear. Oh, so someone's hurting, therefore they should be immune from responsibility, therefore they should be immune from questioning, therefore they should be immune from any downsides in the Anglo-Saxon judicial system? I don't buy it.
To hear the way she was talked to. And she had to speak about probably the most horrendous experience of her life.
Didn't have to do anything. She did not have to participate in this. She chose to do this. Not opposed to her. I'm not for or against anyone here. I'm not an expert in this case. I'm just picking up on individual things that are said and sharing my opinion.
It made me angry.
Are you trying to find something that might undermine or question the alleged victim's credibility?
I think that's fair to say.
They can ask what they want. They can cross-examine, attack the victim's character continually. I have no control, or no district attorney has control over that.
I think that what we're seeing in this case, in this trial, is what I, as a rape crisis advocate, see in any rape trial. We're seeing the victim basically being put on trial.
The victim's put on trial in all sorts of cases. In a traffic accident case, in civil court, right, the plaintiff is going to be put on trial. We're all on trial all the time. People are looking at us. They are judging us. They are judging our words. They are judging what we wear. They're judging our behavior. They're judging our choices. They're judging who we hang out with. We're all on trial. But for these female activists here in this documentary, I overwhelmingly get the sense that they hate, most of all, the idea of female accountability.
It's a typical thing that happens in any rape trial.
In a trial that is...
It's a typical thing to happen in any trial.
It's so highly publicized and so visible. What happens in that trial sends a very powerful message for other victims.
It's highly publicized because you chose to make a criminal case of it. The female who was testifying that she was gang raped. If you'd shut up about it, I'm not saying she should have. I'm not taking any sides on those issues. But plenty of women and plenty of men have suffered at the hands of other people and chosen not to make a case out of it, chosen not to make a criminal case, chosen not to make a civil case. Instead, they've adopted the attitude, there's something here that I can learn from. Let me go and comport myself differently. That's always an option. You don't have to make a federal or a state or a criminal or a civil case out of harms done to you.
Who may be considering pressing charges, bringing their case forward.
I think it's had probably a very harmful effect in the fact that the case has been televised, in the fact that this woman's name has been used in the papers, in some of the papers, and on television.
Stories were made up about Cheryl, you know, lots of myths and stereotypes about who she was, and I'm certain that had a chilling effect.
It's estimated only 1 in 10 rape victims reports the crime to police.
She was a 21-year-old woman, apparently unmarried, with 2 children. So, I mean, how can you lose a reputation beyond that, right? To almost anyone with traditional values, that tells you pretty much all you need to know about a woman. They'd make such bad choices as to have 2 children outside of wedlock and then to be raising the kids instead of giving them up for adoption. I would expect that most people with traditional values consider, okay, this is a woman who makes terrible choices in life. Looking at the chat, Lip One suggests maybe lawyers for the defense should run their questions past the prosecution for approval before asking them.
And even fewer take their cases to court. That ratio was improving in Massachusetts.
Yeah, a lot more people would take their cases to courts if there was no downside, if there's no possible way that they could be held accountable, if there's no possible way that they could be judged, right? If my grandmother was still alive, she'd still be alive, but she's not alive, she's dead.
But that was before this trial.
Victims have to determine a lot of circumstances when they know that they're going to come forward.
Guess what? Men who are accused of crimes and women who are accused of crimes have to face some pretty tough choices as well.
Certainly knowing that you're going to be on trial yourself, everything you've done in the past is going to...
We're all on trial all the time, woman.
...be up there. This trial exemplified that.
In the past 2 weeks, counselors here have received calls from 3 rape victims who are now afraid to take their cases to court, and the same is being reported all over the state.
It's having a devastating negative impact on the victims. They do not want to come forth now. They're hesitant to come forth and prosecute. If there's a chance that their name could be in the newspaper, they're not going to take that chance.
The defendants charged with aggravated rape at Big Dan's Bar 1 year ago watched as each of their lawyers presented closing arguments to the jury.
Ladies and gentlemen, will I ask you, not by sympathy, but by your God-given common sense, to return a verdict of not guilty?
Cheryl Arojo knows, as you know now, that the true story is a gray area indeed.
This is real life. This isn't television, despite the fact that we may be on television. This is not a movie script.
You must determine whether each one individually intended that rape happen, wanted it to happen, desired that it happen.
a little bit more from The Rise of the Warrior Age.
Within about a year and a half of when Lofty had won against Moya, Bartok won against Lofty and became the alpha male.
Well, you could tell because Lofty would come up to Bartok and Pangrunt. Those chimps who play that game of just sheer power never seem to last very long at the top spot. It's the guys who have the social smarts and are able to develop, you know, these social relationships with others and who turn out to last much longer in the alpha position.
Then he did very, very well. He was a very long-tenured alpha male. A lot of these really big-bodied males were really the most aggressive ones out there at the time. Helped him maintain his alpha status. And those were the guys who have ensured that he stayed in power. Really, I think it was some of these other males who were more keen on hunting and patrolling than Bartok was.
Okay, let's go to the wind-up of this Netflix documentary series, Trial by Media, the episode Big Death.
Judge William Young instructed the jury and told them to begin deliberations tomorrow morning. With that and under careful guard, they were sent back to their hotel. Spectators kept at a distance, the windows of their bus covered.
Okay, I think that's going to do it for me for tonight, so take care, everyone. Bye-bye.